I think socialism comes from the heart. I think I've been lucky and I've got what I've got. I've made a few bob, I've had a car, I've got a nice house, and I don't see any reason why everybody shouldn't have that. People who I've met sometimes with a few bob and who've got on don't think everybody else should have a few bob and get on. And I think the opposite. I think everybody can have it. And that's where socialism comes from. I think everybody should have a book. I think everybody should have a nice classroom to go to. I think everybody should have the same opportunities. And I brought my children up to think the same. I brought my children up not to be greedy. My children are generous children. And they're generous not with money or that type of thing, although they do that little bit themselves. They're generous giving themselves to people. They're generous with the smiles, they're generous with the time, and that type of thing.
This is Bristol. It's World War III, week 5. We're a little bit calmer, a so-called ceasefire. Not for long. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 10th of April, 2026, the week of Easter. And we're streaming live from Bristol, a corner of freedom, close by Bristol City Centre, known as the Cumber Centre. Don't believe a word we say, but we do try to share moments of clarity from this Templar port turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the city of London's UK Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com, 11 till 2.30 central time in the middle of the day, 87.7 FM, West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and the Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. This show repeats 11 p.m. and Friday, and I repeat every week, don't I? 11 and 5 a.m. And p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except, and on the app, of course, except for 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. In fact, earlier this week, you would have heard me. I think it was on Tuesday, possibly, maybe even Monday. No, I can't actually remember which day it was, but I was on the on there. So I'm on Richie's show, but also on the app. Lucky listeners can get me 2 days a week if I'm on the Richie Allen show. So this week we've got some guests, Charlie Skelton, because Charlie's the writer that's been getting these comedy pieces in The Guardian about the Bilderbergers for the last decade or so. So the Bilderberg meeting, suddenly we found out this week, I think it was put on a NATO press release on Friday, on Good Friday, and then on Easter Monday, somebody noticed it and circulated it around people that the Bilderberg conference was taking place in Washington, D.C. very quickly, literally within an hour or so. People had worked out which hotel it was, which they couldn't book. So that is called the Salamander Hotel, Maryland Avenue. And so that's where they've all been gathering yesterday and today. So the main 2 days of the Bilderberg conference are Friday and Saturday, but they're there on the Thursday and the Sunday, many of them too. So we'll be talking to Charlie live about it. We're hoping to talk to Dan Dix live from Washington tonight, and also we'll hear Adil Raja, the former Pakistani army officer turned freelance journalist, who's now he'll explain what he thinks is Pakistan's role in brokering this so-called peace deal, because on Tuesday we were being told, weren't we, that's it, folks, we're going to destroy a whole civilization, and yet this is just Trump playing around with his art of the deal. It turns out no, civilization is not going to be wiped out by nuclear weapons, and Trump is going to be nice to the Iranians now, so he's just bouncing everyone around. It's complete chaos, and hence it makes a lot of sense actually to hold one of these Bilderberg conferences 6 weeks early. Most people are preparing for a potential Bilderberg meeting May, June, but normally, I mean, it's never normally this early, so 6 weeks early. But do you want to say something, Martin, about why you think maybe the Bilderbergers have decided to move things forward 6 weeks this year?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious, isn't it? As you just said, there was a potential for none of us to be here, and that's still there, so you might as well get the meeting in now, because otherwise there's not much point having a meeting, is there?
No, and it is. I mean, it could be considered an emergency, what's happened with Trump, can't it? I mean, the guy's been elected to stop World War III, and it seems he's doing his best to start it.
Well, I think what's happened is that this war has been in the works for a long time, but it's not going at all according to plan. So they're now scrambling together to see what they can salvage out of the wreckage. That's what I imagine is going on, but of course it's speculation.
I think it's also quite important. I mean, one of the things that I'd like to say right from the very start, which is this concept of the war party and the intellectual party. So it's like Bilderberg to me seems like the intellectual party. They have links with all of the politicians, the media, etc. They come across as the sensible guys. But at the end of the day, it's someone like Mark Carney. He has put himself out, hasn't he? I mean, we've got the other thing to say about the Bilderberg this week is that we've got two lists. We very rarely get two lists. We've got one which came out on the Monday, which was leaked, and it's marked confidential, which has got basically the same people on, but there are people who've been taken on and off. So we've got an amazing insight, actually, this year into some of the people who they wanted to come or said they'd come, but finally they didn't arrive. And then there's also, interestingly, people who have come that weren't on the original list. So you're getting an insight into the sort of organisational structure of one of these in Bilderberg conferences. So, for example, in the first list, which was marked confidential, can you see that, Martin? Confidential, it says across there. It says from Monday this week, it talks about various people who are not on the official list, but they may be at the conference. We don't know. It may be that they've just been edited off for the public for putting it up on the internet. So one of them is Scott Bessent, the Secretary of Treasury in the United States. Very, very powerful figure. You know, he's basically like Rachel Reeves over here. Then we've also got the Chief Executive of the World Economic Forum, Brenda Borg-Brenda. So they're not on the list. The official list now, but they were slated to be going. Another one is, you know, these are powerful names. Mark Carney, he was supposed to be going to the Bilderberg conference. He's not on the final list. Mette Frederiksen, Prime Minister of Denmark. Obviously, this is all to do with Greenland and things like that. He was on the original list, but he's not on the final. Mette.
She's a
nice lady. Thank you. David Lammy, I mean, couldn't make this up, but on the official list, David Lammy is marked as British Prime Minister.
Well, obviously somebody's made an error.
You think so? It's not wishful thinking, no. Is that maybe there's talk of him becoming Prime Minister if Starmer is out of the way.
They're getting everything together in such a rush, get made.
Obviously, you can't
they?
Get the staff at Bilderberg because he's Secretary of State for Justice and Deputy Prime Minister. Maybe they just missed off the Deputy and the Secretary of State for Justice. But that was quite interesting. Anyway, also Ursula von der Leyen, she was on the original list, the President of Europe, and Mark Rutte. He's gone. Oh, no, hang on. No, he's on both of the lists, Secretary General of NATO. So it's been really quite fascinating to see. Oh, another one, Peter Thiel, who's on Bilderberg Steering Committee. He was on the original list, but not on the final list. But the most important, the most interesting person who has appeared on the final list, not on the original list, is Blaise Metrowelli, the serving head of MI6. And I think we've only in Bilderberg's history had one other serving Director General of MI6 coming to these meetings.
Well, I noticed when I saw the list, the second list that you sent me, Tom Sawyer is on there representing
Mark Sawyer, I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I can't remember. But anyway, he was a former director of MI6.
They've also got the boss of the French intelligence, DGSE, there.
Yeah.
So this is an intelligence gathering, basically. It's the intelligence people telling the elite, whether it's media, royalty. They've got the Dutch, both the Dutch king and queen are over there in Washington at the moment. Also talking about the same issue, which is, oh my God, what are we going to do about Trump?
Well, it's not just about Trump. What are we going to do about the crisis in the global economy and the potential for
war?
That's
what this is all goes back to Trump, doesn't it?
No, Trump, you know, attention seeker as he is, and of course he's very important in all of this, he's not the only factor. I mean, there is basically an underlying crisis here, which would be happening whether Trump was there or not. And of course Trump doesn't help, but it's not the only thing they'd only be talking about.
But a lot of the reasons that they're there, Martin, I would have hoped that you would see this is to do with the economic and war problems that Trump has been causing with this unprovoked illegal attack on Iran. The repercussions around the world are massive, and obviously this is going to be the central topic at the Bilderberg. I've got a list of things they're going to be talking about. Number one is AI. Are we going to manage to get the computers to kill people because people don't want to? And number two is Arctic security. Now, that's clearly code for Greenland.
Yeah, well, Greenland is one part of Arctic security, but of course, as you know, there's a struggle for control of the Arctic, of which argy-bargy-back Greenland is the tip of the iceberg. There's the rest of it. There's all sorts of other issues around the Arctic, which in which Greenland is just one.
No, but that's not why they're talking about it, is it? Because we've got this struggle going on in NATO between the Americans and the Danes.
Yes, but there's also a struggle.
Is it real?
Well, there is a real struggle, but there's also they will also be talking about what's going to happen with the Russians setting up the northern passage across the top of the Arctic there.
What are they doing, the Russians?
Well, they're creating, with the Chinese, a whole another transport corridor. They've got all these nuclear icebreakers, which they've built. They've created all of these ports. And in other words, that is that's been going on for a long time, and that's a big threat to the West's control of the global economy.
China's nowhere near there.
No, but China is close enough that they can sail the ships from China round the top of the Arctic and then to Europe and then into the Atlantic.
Okay,
and
so they don't need to use the Suez Canal.
So they don't need to use the Suez Canal, the Straits of Malacca, etc.
I wonder if Bilderberg is going to be addressing that one.
Well, I mean, these are the fundamentals that the Western elite have to address. Trump having a meltdown is in there as well, but they've still got all these other threats and challenges.
So obviously it goes backwards and forwards between Europe and Washington. This time it was slated to be over, we were guessing it might be in Canada. But Carney is presenting himself as a Bilderberger and as a major figure in opposition to Trump's chaotic world order.
Carney, did you say? Well, he's not turning up, is he?
No, but he is presenting himself as that. And we don't know, by the way. Sometimes people will turn up, maybe do a presentation and go. As I've told many people many, many times, in 1998, Tony Blair was Prime Minister. He wasn't on the list. But I heard directly from a woman who had been working in the canteen that she'd served him breakfast and he'd stayed the previous night.
Well, also, do you remember Lammy turned up and his name wasn't on the list and they wouldn't let him in? Do you remember?
Well, his name was on the list, but it's just that they didn't trust him. They didn't trust him or recognise him, no. That's happened to several. It also happened to Ed Balls, the same thing. All these Fabians they get. So I think they're left-wingers and they're maybe not trusted.
Well, anyway, with speculation, Tony.
It's not speculation that he couldn't get in. No. It's quite right that he couldn't. He had to hide behind a bush. This is when we were in Portugal a couple of years ago, poor old David Lammy, and somebody went over and said to him, David, it's okay, they've said you can come in now. So he came out. He didn't really trust anyone, but it was one of the photographers, I think it was Giorgio, may have been Giorgio, went to said to him, Mr. Lammy, you can come in now. You go to the conference, they've asked, they said it's okay. So that's the kind of security you have to deal with. We don't even know who you are. Maybe that's the sort of psychology to let the politicians like him, who is slated to be his deputy prime minister of this country, to know his place.
Well, yes. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of hierarchy involved in these kind of affairs.
So who's at the top?
Well, I don't know. The aliens, probably, Tony. I don't know. I think the problem is, for the elite, is that they used to have a fairly solid consensus about what they wanted to do. But then now, of course, you know, as their vital interests are threatened, it turns out that they don't necessarily see eye to eye on the way forward. And that's presumably why they brought the meeting forward, to try and thrash out some kind of solution, inverted commas.
If you were in there and had a chance to have a presentation to all these Western world so-called democratic leaders, what would you say?
Well, you probably need to abolish Bilderberg and do something else completely different.
Well, no. These think tanks are actually quite useful. I mean, first, if I was to say anything, I would say you should allow a press conference at the very least at the meeting, and let somebody speak to the press, maybe one of the two chairs. But secondly, you need some other ideas. So sort of let's think about things like the Steve Keen type ideas, people like you, Martin. The Varoufakis type people, they never go to the Bilderberg.
Well, I mean, the thing is, there's two things there. A, they're not invited because they'd be party poopers.
They'll rock the boat, will they?
Yeah, and B, even if they went there, that they don't necessarily want to go. You know, it's not really a feather in your cap.
Oh, no, no, hang on, I'm sure they do. A lot of these people would like to have the chance to meet all these
high flyers. Some people do not want to go at all because they, you know, Bilderberg's got a reputation for being a fix-it for the super elite. Now, if you don't want to be part of the super elite and you regard them as the enemy, you don't necessarily want to tie your flag to their mast, do you?
One of the most fascinating aspects of all of this, I think, is the way that the Fabian Society have been. We had a whole piece about that last week on the Easter 2026 programme. What do you think of the Fabians? Because they have been, I mean, like Lamy is, the Bilderbergs seem to think they're fine, even though they won't necessarily let them in without double-checking who they are. They're the sort of acceptable form of the left.
Well, the Fabian Society, you know, has got a long history which we could go into, but in recent years it's very much been associated with the Starmerite, Blairite wing of the Labour Party. And that, of course, is acceptable to the powers that be. Jeremy Corbyn, no invite for him. Yeah.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to another clip from last week's piece on this. Is actually I think I've got another one here, which is actually Matt Errett talking about the Fabian Society, because I think we need to really need. I've been chatting to some of the Bilderbergers, not them themselves, but people covering it for years, and they always say, well, the Fabian Society is clearly a major part of this.
A lot of those who are expected to act like obedient feudal serfs were not acting that way when their lives were so clearly being abused and threatened. So you'd get all sorts of rebellions across the empire. So I think the empire was sort of falling apart, especially by the end of the 19th century. Nation states, there's a recognition by many leaders of Asia, of Russia, even in Europe. Sidi Carnot was a president of France, a major industrialist, Otto von Bismarck had his Humboldtian networks in Germany that had just recently been unified around certain principles of economics and national economics that had proven themselves to work very well when they were done first in the United States under protective tariffs. You know, this is the basis of the German Zollverein, was modeled on what Hamilton had done under the colonies to unify the colonies into becoming a viable nation with a national bank and directed credit towards big projects that were very, very advanced as far as building railroads, you know, canal systems that were big and that allowed for nations to utilize national sovereign power to take their destiny into their own hands. The American population had expanded quite a bit. I think the population quadrupled in the first 40 years based on these policies, despite them being often done quite sloppily, but in principle, it demonstrated that the sovereign nation state could exert an influence over the private banking sector in the benefit and in accordance with some idea of some moral law that was associated with the welfare of the people, which allowed for the overcoming of the limits to growth logic of the Malthusians. And so this was done so well under especially Lincoln, who was able to maintain the Union despite a lot of support by the British Empire to break up America during the 1861 to 65 period, that nations who had supported America in that fight, I'm thinking here primarily of Russia, which intervened directly under Alexander II to support the Union. Alexander II adopted many of Lincoln's policies immediately after the Civil War, even after Lincoln was dead, to build the Trans-Siberian Railway, apply protective tariffs to Russia. State banks were created by Sergei Vita, the finance minister. And American U.S.-Russian relations were really healthy at that time. And you had similar people in China in the 1890s adopting and applying this principle under the 100 Days Reform of 1894, which was subverted to extend rail from Russia down into China and up through the Bering Strait into Alaska that had just been sold to the Americans in 1867. You know, so you have this idea that nations could liberate themselves from British control of sea power. The maritime controls of choke points was how the British empire was able to exert its influence over the world. You know, you don't have to control everything. You just have to control 12 or 13 global choke points on the seas and keep everybody addicted to sea power. Mm. And that was slipping away from the empire as nations were developing their inland territories, developing industrial corridors, new networks of education were blossoming, new inventions were happening as people were solving big problems, engineering problems that were not solvable with the previous earlier primitive set of knowledge. So, and they were working together. There was an idea of cooperation as something that would supersede the age of Hobbesian geopolitics. So that I think was the crisis of empire that sets the stage by the 1870s for the decision to do some soul searching. I guess you could say if there is a soul in the empire, they had to do a bit of crisis management and some soul searching to think like, well, what will be the future of the empire? Are we able to exist in this world where nations are breaking free and declaring their own sovereign destiny in, you know, outside of our system of controls? So the Fabian Society was created in 1884 as a part of this, as one of several dominant think tanks. It grew out of something that was called the Fellowship of the New Life, which was set up by, I think, 12 or so figures around this Thomas Davidson character, promoting, you know, Tolstoy's worldview, basic simplistic concepts of simple living, vegetarianism, absolute passivism, unconditional passivism under all circumstances, think little, think local, logic. And a lot of basically all of the founding members of the Fabians grew out of this previous organization the year earlier, and also overlapped another entity that was created in the 1770s called the Theosophists, of which there were a couple early Fabians that became Theosophists, even led the Theosophists, namely Annie Besant, who replaced Madame Blavatsky. You had Frank Paul de Moor, another figure who is also promoting this. And so each one of these things were sort of trying to meet different aspects of the failures of the empire. You also had the Roundtable movement that grew out of Lord Milner's kindergarten. That was sort of a more aggressive branch of or type of think tank that had was designed around the same time with many overlapping members throughout the years, including Milner, but many others over the years that would overlap with the Fabians. And, you know, while the Fabians had a more socialistic sort of branding, utilizing it early on the founding documents of Marx and his manifesto, both with their American branches of the Fabian Society promoting Marx in America, but also in Britain, that satisfied or tried to appeal to labor, the poor, and essentially attract and rally groupings of impoverished plebeians into some weaponized mob that could be deployed by a higher elite that didn't really like them in the first place.
Yeah, so that's Matt Errett talking about the Fabians. Links to the Theosophists, I didn't know about that, Martin, did you?
Well, I mean, at that stage, people were very intellectually curious, so there's all sorts of things they were interested in. Annie Besant was a very interesting character because she was a radical journalist in the East End of London, and she made a name for herself supporting the Match Girls strike, and they were teenage girls who were made to make matches, and she organised them into a union, and they got unionised. She then went out to India and got involved in the Indian National Congress, so she was very much involved in setting that up. And she was a leftist, inverted commas, but she also had spiritualist leanings, you know, so, and that was fairly common at the time. If you think back to the 1960s, sort of hippie ideology, it began in the 1890s with people like her.
So do you know any Fabians in the Labour Party?
Apart from the
obvious leadership, which is, well, I mean, it's extraordinarily Fabian, isn't it? I mean, it's gone from being something which is a small group of people to now what is actually the most powerful group within the Labour Party.
Well, it's not, the Fabian Society itself is not entirely homogenous. So Mike Jacobs is a Fabian, and he's fairly, I would say he's very close to sort of green ideas. He wrote the book The Green Economy. I met him when I used to work for NEF. And the Fabians were originally, the concept of Fabians is named after Fabius Maximus, who is the Roman general that defeated Hannibal. And the way he defeated Hannibal is he refused to fight him in open combat. And he just basically waited Hannibal out until Hannibal's armies fell apart. So the whole concept of Fabianism was socialism through reform rather than revolution. So that was the whole idea of Fabianism. We're going to have a socialist society, but it'll come out bit by bit. And, of course, it was very influential in the Labour government of the 1940s. I mean,
and what about setting up the Labour Party?
Well, the setting up of the Labour Party was problematic. The Fabians were... H.G. Wells and people like that were more influenced by what you call Fabianism, but the Labour Party was already in existence by that stage. So the Fabians were middle-class people, by and large, educated types, whereas the Labour Party initially had been set up by trade unionists with, their agenda. But, of course, these intellectual history discussions are interesting, but, there's an awful lot in there that you need to read a lot about.
Absolutely key, because all this is going on at the same time as the setting up of Zionism, for example.
Well, I mean, that's in the late 19th century, Irish nationalism was being set up.
Yeah.
Chinese nationalism was being set up. You know, this is the period when, with the 19th century coming to an end and all these new technologies coming on stream, where everybody was looking to the future and thinking, what's the future going to look like?
I think in a way also, it was the power of the British Empire at the time, the spread of the British Empire. People were getting ideas like Cecil Rhodes did into their head. Well, if we play this right, we can take over the world.
Well, I mean, Milner and Rhodes were pretty clear that what we needed to do, if you look at their writings and so on, is we need to get together with the Americans, and then we need to take over the world. Because the British Empire obviously aspired to take over the world, but then the Americans broke away. And obviously the whole idea, and this of course comes back to the Bilderberg concept, is if we get together with the Americans, then we can take over the world as a joint enterprise. And there's an awful lot of what's been going on, which very much fulfills that, doesn't it? Let's face it. The British and the US and the Israelis, because the state was created by this British-American nexus, they are the would-be emperors of the world.
You haven't said anything about eugenics, have you, in the Fabian Society?
Well, all eugenics was absolutely universal right across the political spectrum in that period. It was only because Hitler was obsessed with eugenics that eugenics became a dirty word. But everybody wanted...
Fabians were talking about exterminating people.
Well,
we were hearing last week, you have an interview to justify your existence. If you don't pass it, you get killed.
Well, then, or you just sterilise people so they can't have babies, so you don't have to kill anybody, you just can't have any babies.
But Bertrand Russell was talking about killing people.
Well, I mean, the point is, Tony, that even now the tech bro billionaires would like to see lots of poor people dead. Yeah. Because they're useless eaters.
What I'm trying to point out is that you've got this rather nasty bunch attaching both to left and right. It's not as if it's just
eugenics was common across the spectrum in intellectual circles at that time. Princeton Churchill was very much in favour of eugenics, and he was no kind of socialist. All the wealthy classes were in favour of eugenics because what they feared was the disorderly poor and their hordes of children with, begging on the streets. So what we've got to do is we're going to have an orderly socialist or capitalist society or whatever it's going to be, and we're going to get rid of all these disorderly poor people having babies and messing, creating mess.
So we've had this... What do you make of this decision by Donald Trump this week to decide he's not going to wipe Iran off the map?
Well, I think everybody woke up on that morning thinking, phew, he's not done it. Because that's the real danger, is it may well be that he said that's what we're going to do and the military told him not to, because, of course, they've sacked a lot of the military leadership. Hegseth went round and sacked a load of generals this week.
Well, Hegseth is a numpty. He's in no position to do
yes,
that.
I know. So why is he in the position to sack generals who are actually sophisticated, intelligent people, even if they're on the wrong side? They actually know about warfare, unlike Hegseth, who doesn't. So why did they get rid of them? It's quite likely because they were saying, well, don't do this because it's going to fail.
One of the big events that's been put into the news, we've had two, essentially. We've had the destruction of the American airbase, or large numbers of American aircraft, at Prince Sultan Air Base. That was a couple of weeks ago. Then we've also had this spectacular rescue, supposedly, of this American airman in Iran, in the middle of Iran. So before we hear your take, Martin, let's have a listen to the official kind of news version of what happened.
The dangerous rescue mission took American commandos deep inside Iran, with US forces reportedly bombing Iranian convoys to keep them away from the missing colonel. His hiding place, a mountain crevice, at one point hiking up a 7,000-foot ridgeline to evade detection. It was a two-day life-or-death race between U.S. and Iranian forces. "We got him," Trump posted in the early hours of Sunday, saying the colonel sustained injuries but will be just fine, and no Americans were killed or wounded in the operation. Later, posting the missing officer was seriously wounded. As day broke, smoldering wreckage, said to be an American plane and helicopter, lay scattered across the Iranian desert. Iran's military claimed they destroyed two Black Hawk helicopters and two military transport planes. The U.S. says it had to destroy at least one aircraft because it malfunctioned. When the F-15 fighter jet was shot down on Friday, the other airman was rescued quickly, but his weapons systems officer was missing in action. To buy time, US reports say the CIA spread a rumor he'd already been found. The US is claiming victory, but so is Iran.
The so-called rescue operation by the U.S. Army, which was planned to rescue its downed aircraft pilot at an abandoned airport in southern Isfahan, ended in complete failure.
Today, Iranian drones targeted energy facilities across the Gulf, hitting state energy complexes, power and desalination plants in Kuwait, an oil facility in Bahrain, and a petrochemical plant in Abu Dhabi. This a day after Israel targeted Iran's largest petrochemical complex.
It is mutually hurting on both sides, but not hurting enough for them to decide that they would have to get to the negotiating table and compromise. There are messages that are still being conveyed by the mediators, but I still don't see sufficient political will and flexibility on both sides to bring them to the finish line and get to some sort of a ceasefire.
Trump has given until Monday to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, or he'll attack Iran's critical infrastructure. Early Sunday, deploying his distinct brand of diplomacy with a new message and yet another deadline. Tuesday will be Power Plant Day and Bridge Day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Open the f***ing strait, you crazy bastards, or you'll be living in hell. In Tehran, they've already hung their catch out to dry. The strait will stay closed, this billboard reads.
This is the version of events there, Martin. What do you think really happened there last weekend?
Well, obviously, it's very hard to disentangle the propaganda from the reality, but it looks to me, of the stuff I've been reading, the people who seem to be able to assess this better, this was an attempt to try and go into what is a nuclear complex, pretend that they'd captured some, nuclear material, and then Trump could have said, look, we've captured their nuclear material, we've got a victory there, that's it. But of course, in actual fact, the Iranians were waiting for them, and they didn't get anywhere near, because this airstrip that they were using is quite close to where the nuclear facility is. But the Iranians were waiting for them, as you might imagine, and it didn't work.
So they had, was it two or three Hercules aircraft that flew in?
Well, listen, there's all sorts of stuff out there. People
these
need to check
Hercules
it for
aircraft
They're
managed
massive.
To get stuck in the mud.
That's right. Well, it's an airstrip that was used usually for crop spraying. So if you try and land a huge, great military aircraft on it, it's quite likely you're going to come to grief.
It does look as if they're maybe their intelligence isn't that good, that they're just looking at this from the satellite, and they're maybe even asking AI, what can we do?
Well, also, the common sense part of it is, why would you imagine that you could get into Iran, fairly deep into Iran, get into a nuclear complex, get the stuff out, and get out? It's most likely that you're not going to succeed, which is probably why some of these generals resigned. It's like, this isn't going to work. And of course,
did they resign or were they sacked?
They were sacked, but the point is they're probably saying you shouldn't do this because it's going to fail. And Trump and Hegseth overruled them and said, yeah, but it's going to be great. And of course, it hasn't been great, predictably enough. I mean, think about it. It's a really silly operation.
Well, another major thing, of course.
Not much point to it in the first place.
I did an interview yesterday with Warren Thornton about the Bilderberg conference, actually. But as he was pointing out, and none of the mainstream press seem to have pointed this out, is this airman. Who is he? Where is he? He's apparently sort of national hero.
Yes, well, that's
He's not even appeared.
Well, it may be that he doesn't
Does
even
he exist?
Exist? Yeah. Well, that's just the point. Also, other things have been pointed out that you normally wouldn't have somebody of that rank on such a mission. So there's plenty of anomalies here. And of course, the US have now got a reputation for just making stuff up on the fly. So you don't take anything they say seriously.
Well,
you'd be a fool to do so.
It's not surprising that world leaders think it's a good idea to get together pronto in order to try and do something about this mania that's going on with the US empire. And who better to talk to about what's going on than Press for Truth's Dan Dix, who's joining us on the line now from Washington, D.C. Hi, Dan, can you hear me?
I can, yeah. Thank you for having me, guys. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you. But can you just give us an idea what the relationship at the moment is like between the Canadians generally and the United States? Because the whole world is looking at America thinking, well, we've got a basket case running the show.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the situation with both countries, really. I mean, up in Canada, we've got Mark Carney, who is no stranger to the Bilderberg Group. The man's been going since, I believe, 2011, and he's been to many, many meetings since then. At one point, even on the steering committee, and now he's Prime Minister of Canada. So this guy, in my view, has been a selection of the Bilderberg Group. I mean, famously, Stephen Harper attended the meeting once in 2003, I believe it was, and 2 years later, this relatively unknown guy becomes Prime Minister of Canada. And now we have a similar situation with this guy, Mark Carney, who has been a very close friend of Bilderberg. Of course, he's a former central bankster, as I like to call them. He was the governor of the Bank of Canada, governor of the Bank of England, and now turned Prime Minister of Canada. And I successfully called that at the 2024 Bilderberg meeting.
Well
saying
done. Yeah.
That they're eyeing him as the next Prime Minister of Canada, because I think they need a central bankster, because it's very possible that he's going to be used for the next phase of introducing digital CBDCs,
but anyway,
central bank digital
Dan,
currencies.
Yeah, that's very important. And maybe you could just give us, for anyone that's not really familiar, including almost the entire London media, with Bilderberg, why is it that, can you just describe what is the function of this big get-together, and why is it it's so interesting that it's 6 weeks early this year?
Sure. Well, this is a meeting for anybody who's not super familiar. We're talking about 120 to 150 people on average, some of the world's most powerful and influential people, presidents and prime ministers and kings and queens and military men and media moguls and leaders of finance who are meeting in secret every single year behind closed doors. There's no minutes of the meeting. There's no audio. There's no video. There's no nothing. The public is not invited. And the reason why this is significant is because the Bilderberg Group are the ones who are often setting up world-shaping events. They famously were the ones who kind of hatched the idea for the European Union. This idea of European countries giving up their national sovereignty, giving up their own currencies, some of them that have been around for thousands of years, and exchanging it for the euro. This was all hatched at Bilderberg. You have, similarly, around the time of 9/11, the idea of getting into the Middle East, and it was at Bilderberg, where, as I like to call them, the inner circle of the inner circle, convinced the delegates that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And then, sure enough, when you have all these heads of media, you have all these war hawks in attendance, they're going to take this information and they're going to send it out like a ripple effect into the minds of the masses. And so this is how they operate. So I think the purpose of it is to not only use their sphere of influence to be able to shape and mold the world in their direction, which, let's be clear, it's towards an eventual one world government. But I don't think everybody who attends Bilderberg is necessarily aware of this agenda. It's not like just because you get invited to the meeting that you are involved in some sort of nefarious plan for a new world order. That's not exactly how this works. As I said, I think it's an inner circle within the inner circle who not only hatches the plan, puts it into the minds of the delegates, who then put it into the minds of the masses. But yeah, they also are recruiting the next up and coming potential influential people who they can pull into their inner circle. So I would almost call it like an Illuminati summer training camp, where they're scouting for the next inner circle invitee, and they're also using these people's sphere of influence to execute their plans. And again, let's be clear what the plans are. We're talking about a one world government. We're talking about a one world cash system. We're talking about a one world army to police anybody who wants to go against this, and eventually a one world religion. So this is what this meeting is about, when you've got 150 to 120 of some of the world's most powerful people meeting in secret.
Yeah, and they're from the NATO countries. It's important. They're not just from anywhere. NATO's quite obviously an important transatlantic military alliance, been going since the Second World War. It's now, and I notice there's one of the delegates actually, NATO is spreading its wings. It's moving to the Pacific and the Indian Ocean. It's moving to Asia. Yes. Asia. So there is one of the representatives from that part of NATO is there too. But look, the timing is everything. And we've had ever since Christmas, we've had Donald Trump doing all these crazy stuff, like talking about taking over Greenland. That's on the agenda when it talks about the Arctic security. But the point really here is that Carney is not apparently there, although he was on the unofficial list, so he may be turning up just to do a presentation. So he's not on the official list. But that there is a faction within Bilderberg who is seen as the kind of sensible guys in the room in the NATO countries. So if you're in the NATO countries, you're looking at Trump, you're going, oh my God, what's he up to? Surely, actually, Bilderberg is fulfilling quite an important positive role here in countering this idea that Trump seems to want to start a third world war.
Yes, well, that could very well be why this is happening in April. I mean, this is the first time we've seen this meeting happen in April since the Greece meeting in 1993. So there's been nothing like this for 33 years. It's kind of out of the ordinary. It's unprecedented. So it does seem there's something going on. And when you have the Secretary of the Army of the United States and you have the Secretary General of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, meeting here in secret at a time when Trump is in the middle of his epic fury campaign, so to speak, against Iran, it really makes you wonder what they're talking about. Because NATO cannot just invoke Article 5 and go after a country like Iran, because they can only do that when the country attacks one of their member states. And they weren't attacked. Iran didn't attack anybody. It was the United States and Israel who preemptively striked first. So NATO is not in a position to be able to get involved in this conflict in such a way because of that very fact. They're the ones who hit first. So considering that this is all happening now in the midst of this campaign to take down Iran, it begs the question, why is the Secretary General of NATO meeting with these guys right now in the midst of this war? We know they have an agenda to go into the Middle East. We know that they started out with Iraq and then Afghanistan and then, you know, Libya and Syria, Sudan, Iran. They're all, everyone's on the chopping block and has been for quite some time. It's just a matter of how are they going to pull this off, and how are they going to get the American people and the people of the world behind this? Because it's not enough anymore to just say that this is some sort of humanitarian mission. I think people are maybe not buying it. I would like to hope to think so anyways. You know, we've heard about the weapons of mass destruction. We've heard about the babies in the incubators. We've heard about all this stuff that has drummed it up for the people to want to get behind these wars. But, you know, now I would like to think that the majority of people are starting to see through these types of lies. And so now maybe they're here to, you know, in the midst of this war to kind of come up with some new strategies and some new plans. I mean, one of the agendas, the topics, was the future of warfare. I did a little video report about that, kind of discussing that could kind of tie in with their AI agenda. But you got to consider the fact that there's a lot of heavy tech representation here and military men. So it is very interesting timing indeed.
Well, I was very surprised that Peter Thiel wasn't in the final list. He was in the original list. Now, mm-hmm. He's a very important figure in Bilderberg. He's also controversial in that he's been recently doing these pronouncements about the end of the world and the Antichrist, which is very curious for somebody to be doing that at such a meeting. But look, you haven't quite answered the question I originally said, because surely the idea here is that Bilderberg, you know, you could almost say thank God for Bilderberg. You've got a maniac in the White House who seems hell-bent on starting a third world war, and at least there are a few sensible people in the room, including the head of MI6, Blaise Metrowelli, whose grandfather was a Nazi sympathiser. The point is that actually it's very important, actually, in the West, that we've got something like the Bilderbergers, and they're coming across in a way as a sort of sensible guys when set against Donald Trump and the Israelis.
Well, that's an interesting standpoint, but I'm personally of the opinion that you don't get to a point of being president of the United States unless the powers that ought not be, as I like to call them, are going to allow that to happen. Now, whether or not, to the extent of how much Donald Trump may know that he is being used as a puppet, can be debated, certainly. But I think indeed this organization is above that kind of a public level, and these are the guys who are pulling the strings. So I'm not really necessarily looking at them as the saviors of the situation. I'm looking at them as the ones potentially pulling the strings behind the scenes.
Well, I do agree with you to a certain extent. I think they play both sides. The idea is they want to control both sides of the chessboard. But there is a fact, isn't there, about the Straits of Hormuz being closed. This is a massive international economic disaster. And so there's a whole bunch of very wealthy, powerful people, maybe Bilderberg represents that faction too, that are saying, well, we've got to do something to open the Straits of Hormuz again. We've got to stop this idiot who's crashing the world economy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, crashing the world economy is, you know, a part of the overall agenda, because that's what's exactly going to have to happen if you're going to want an eventual one world digital currency, a centralized banking digital currency. You're going to have to do away, just like they did with the formation of the European Union. They managed to convince all these countries to give up their sovereignty and their money for a euro. It's going to happen on a global scale. So I think the crash of the US dollar, the crash of the petrodollar, the crash of the economy is essentially a part of the plan. And now, whether or not they're going to use Donald Trump as the fall guy, you know, the one to pin the blame on, that can be debated. And how much is he going to actually be involved in the implementation of this can be debated as well. But from what I can tell, this is what the agenda is. This is what the plan is. And again, I don't think necessarily any of these guys are going to be trying to stop it.
Okay, so who is there actually covering it? Have you got the big Canadian media, big American media? I bet you haven't. It's just you and a few other people. I wonder what you guys and girls, whoever's actually over there in Washington covering it, what's your sort of chit chat in the evening, over supper, over breakfast, this sort of thing?
Yeah, there's really just a handful of the crew this year. It's Let me think. Me and three other guys. it's really just four of us, and we're all different individual independent medias. We have myself, there's Josh Friedman, there's a guy named Frederico from Portugal. This is his fourth Bilderberg. Josh has covered probably 8 or 10 of them. There's another guy, Joseph, who's covered 2 or 3 of these. And this is my 20th year, as a matter of fact, covering Bilderberg. Wow. The first one I did was in 2006 in Ottawa, Canada. So I'm a little bit of the OG here when it comes to the independent media covering this. But certainly, there is no mainstream on the outside of this. There's no cameras anywhere. Yeah. It's really just the four of us. And so, yeah, when we go, you know, inevitably to dinner, we're going to talk about what each other got, because right now I'm in the front. We got another guy on the side. We got two others at the back. We like to spread out to kind of work together and to cover every potential angle. And I'm just waiting to hear from them if they're getting any action in the back, and yeah. I'm kind of hanging out in the
so
front.
The Bilderbergers are forced to use the tunnels.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, I think they've also forced to switch up their strategies at the airports, because that in the past has been an excellent place for us to get those face-to-face conversations, those head-on confrontations and interviews with some of the delegates has always been at the airport. But I think in recent years, they've kind of caught on to that and are working on other ways of getting them through the airport where they don't have to deal with us. But certainly right here, I mean, they've got these giant green screens, sunscreen type things that you can't really film through. And it wraps around the entire building, and it's pretty much an impenetrable fortress at this point.
Well, listen, you know what that tells me? That tells me that there are people in there that they don't want photographed, and they don't want people to know are in there. Because obviously you can't tell anything just by taking a photograph of somebody through a window about what they're saying. But they don't. There will be people, I can guarantee now, there will be people in that meeting that they would much rather that the journalists didn't know were actually there. Anyway, Dan, have you noticed much over the years difference between the conferences of the Bilderberg that are being held in North America and those in Europe?
Yeah, interestingly, this is something that we were discussing over dinner just the other night, and I was just saying to my fellow colleague here earlier today, is I'm kind of shocked at the level of security and police here in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C. It's really not that much. I mean, I'm not getting harassed like I do when I'm covering Bilderberg in Europe. I mean, when I was in Germany, it was horrific. I got detained dozens of times. Every 5 feet, I couldn't even walk without a cop demanding my identification and telling me to stop filming. I had the German police try to sue me personally for putting their faces on video. I had to blur it out. At the time, YouTube had a feature where you could blur faces after the fact. So I ended up having to do that. Otherwise, I would have been sued. And interestingly enough, not like here in the West, they would be able to sue me as an individual. Even though they're donning the uniform, they're both public and private at the same time. And they wouldn't be the police suing me. It'd be a private individual suing me, even though he's in a uniform working.
But hang on, these police, Dan, these police will be out in the public space. Surely, you're not in a private space taking pictures of them, are you? In a private house or something?
No. In Germany, I was right out on a public sidewalk. And I'm used to what it's like here in the U.S. and Canada, where it's like, hey, if I'm in a public sidewalk and you're a public servant, I have every right to film you. You cannot even ask for my identification. You know, you can't just demand papers. You need probable cause. You need to proof of some sort of a crime being committed. That wasn't the case in Germany. They were able to just they came into my hotel room in Germany and interrogated me inside my room. I was thrown in jail in Copenhagen, Denmark, covering this thing many, many years ago just for simply questioning the steering committee. They literally arrested me and threw me in jail. And so now, you know, coming into the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C., I expected something similar just because of the location. But honestly, it's surprisingly low key here right now. I'm walking around in front of the hotel right now. unmolested. They're not really, nobody's bothering me. And I guess that's because they have a First Amendment here in America. So that's maybe the difference. So that's one thing I've noticed. Very, very significant difference compared to my coverage in Europe.
Okay, so what about this war, this Iran war? What do you think? Can you guess what they'll be talking about in there? Because I don't think we've ever had anything. I mean, you know, you mentioned the weapons of mass destruction, or we did, talking about the illegal invasion of Iraq back in 2003. This time, 2026, we've had an illegal invasion that not only is illegal, it's also totally unprovoked, and there's no plan. There is actually this. It just seems we're just going to hammer somebody, and then we've actually got no plan for whether it be regime change or to get rid of their so-called nuclear material, and no mention, of course, of the genocide being carried out by the Israelis, our apparent allies, and their 200 yeah. nuclear weapons that they've got. So what do you think may be going on in their minds, and has been going on in your mind and Canadians and people's minds about this unprecedented move that Trump has made?
Yeah, it's really tough to say, but you know, just kind of stepping back and taking a look at it all, you see that we're being manipulated into this notion of Iran having these nuclear weapons that they're going to potentially use any day now, and you've got Netanyahu saying that literally for 30 years going on the record saying they're just weeks away, they're just months away, they're just days away. And that's been happening over and over and over and over and over again. So I really hope that people are kind of not buying it anymore. You had the talk of like the Bashar al-Assad using chemical weapons against his own people. You had the Saddam Hussein thing with weapons of mass destruction. It's getting old. And they wanted Iran for a long time now. Iran has been on the chopping block for a long time. So maybe they're realizing it's time to come up with a new strategy. Because honestly, I don't know how many people are buying it. Although, like I said, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think people are really buying this idea that Iran is planning on doing something major. Why would they? If, as far as I know, they haven't attacked another country in like, I don't know, 300 years preemptively, just out of nowhere for no reason. It's always been defensive stuff. So, I mean, maybe that's the discussion, this particular year is how do we get people behind this war, you know, and to support it all out. And and obviously this is pure speculation, but maybe, you know, false flag attacks, that's their modus operandi, that's their kind of their one-way ticket in how to convince people to be against someone. And if anybody's not familiar with that, any of your listeners, this is a military concept of flying the flag of another country on an attack so that you can blame your political enemies for something that you did. So they very well could be setting up a plan like that. And I don't think this is a discussion that happens in the main room at Bilderberg. Again, I think there's an inner circle within the inner circle. And I think when it comes down to the nitty gritty details of what they're going to do in Iran, these types of discussions happen with the war hawks and the inner circle at the bar and at the, you know, hanging out in the lounge. And I think that's where some of the real things, major decisions are made at Bilderberg.
Yeah, well, I think it's fascinating looking through, just picking, I'm going to pick out one or two of the confirmed participants. One of them is a British guy, apparently, Demis Hassabis, who's a co-founder and chief executive of Google DeepMind. This is the AI branch. We've also got the chief executive of Palantir, funded into his job by Peter Thiel. That's Alex Karp. He's there. It's basically big business, isn't it? And then you see people like Albert Bourla, chair and chief executive of Pfizer. So it seems to me you've got this almost like big pharma, the military industrial complex, all of the big companies that are making a lot of money, that are consolidating, monopolizing their fields, etc., and they're also using the mass media to bamboozle people like the Pfizer lot into thinking that they're marvellous and stopping people like you and I, information getting out about to the public about how dangerous their various products are, whether it's being AI drones killing people or injections, that sort of thing. So you're dealing actually with an enormous kind of the military industrial complex plus all these other industrial complexes with all the people that actually finance it all too. So why is it, do you think, that the press, the mass media just turn the other way?
Well, largely it's because most of the significant ones are on the inside, and you know, they're under what's called Chatham House rules. They're not really allowed to discuss what has been discussed. They can talk briefly about the meeting and things of that nature, but they can't quote anybody. They can't say who said what. And largely there's just been a media blackout, for a number of reasons, because that's part of the agenda. But also today's media is not really doing a good job. They're not aware of these types of, things. So I think there's a bit of it's double faced. It's a media blackout on purpose because of the sphere of influence that people on the inside here have over the media. And it's also just people failing to do their jobs. And again, this is why we're here. This is precisely why I come time and time again. I think this is my 13th or 14th one I've covered since 2006. And I'm not about to go away anytime soon because somebody has to do it. Yeah. There's literally not a single camera here other than four little old independent journalists just trying to, you know, expose some of the world's most powerful and evil people meeting behind closed doors. So, yeah, I hope that changes sometime soon. But, you know, maybe if somebody big enough and significant enough in the media does try to cover it, they realize they would lose their jobs. Interestingly enough, one time when I was covering Bilderberg in Austria, I believe it was, there was a G7 meeting happening, and I was on the inside of the Bilderberg Hotel in Austria during lockdown. And the reason why I managed to get in there during lockdown was because they thought incorrectly that I was a part of the White House press corps who was there to cover the G7. And what they were doing was they were flying these media guys out on a helicopter from the Bilderberg Hotel to the G7 in Munich, I believe it was at the time. And I was up in the cigar room, and I came across some of the heads of the mainstream media who were there. We're talking CNN, MSNBC, and one other one. It was three guys. And when we discussed the fact that they are there to cover G7, I said, wait, do you not know what's happening in this very hotel? Like, the hotel we are currently in, Bilderberg is meeting here in the next day or two, and you guys are covering the G7 in Munich. Like, are you not aware of what's happening in this hotel? And no, they weren't. They were completely clueless. In fact, some of them were like, what's Bilderberg? You know, and I was just like, wow. They were literally the heads of certain mainstream media outlets who were inside the Bilderberg Hotel during lockdown, and they had no clue that the meeting was even taking place.
Well, it's interesting because Peter Mandelson, who's obviously been met to many of the Bilderberg meetings, he's now been arrested. I'm not sure that he's obviously a friend of Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. He is somebody, one of the people I knew in the 1990s when I was working in the mass media in London, early 90s, that he was actually going around literally identifying journalists that he didn't like and that his friends didn't like and getting them removed from their jobs. And so we have a media, it seems to me now, that is actually compliant. So not only that, of course, the way he got them removed from their jobs is because of his connections in the City of London, the people who finance the big media organisations. And I don't think the BBC was one of them, no, because that's got its licence fee. What they would do is they contact the general manager of the organisation, say, this journalist here, they're writing things we don't like and we would like you to remove them. So you end up with getting a media which is actually not serving the readers. It's just serving the City of London or Wall Street or the financiers of the press. So it's very important you carrying on. Maybe you could just wind up, Dan, by letting listeners know whereabouts to find you. I'll make sure that this little chat with you is up online and shared later on this evening. But whereabouts can they find your feeds and support your work?
Sure, thank you for that. Right now, I mean, pressfortruth.ca is probably the best place to go, and there you can get links to all my channels. I'm on, you know, YouTube and Rumble and BitChute and Odyssey and a whole bunch of platforms like that, 8 or 9 different platforms. But for my most up-to-date coverage of Bilderberg, the best place to go is probably X, my Twitter account, which is Dan Dix, D-I-C-K-S, Dan Dix, P-F-T. I'm putting, you know, a lot of clips up there first and foremost, and then a little later down the road tonight, I will edit it all together and put it into a YouTube video. But you could also search Press for Truth on YouTube. But again, the best place to go is probably pressfortruth.ca. And if anybody wants to support my efforts, I do have a Go Get Funding campaign for this particular trip. Here in Washington, D.C., and that's you can find that in the link of any of my socials right now.
Okay, well, it's not quantity, it's quality that counts. Dan Dix, quality. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Thank
Keep up the great work.
Much.
Take care.
Cheers, Dan. And we're going to go now to have a listen to Charlie Skelton, who I spoke to yesterday evening and did a bit of an analysis with him. He's a Guardian journalist and a comedy writer. Apparently, tomorrow evening's Saturday Night Live. He's been working on that on Sky, which I think you have to pay for to watch it, annoyingly. But anyway, it's a kind of Murdoch's cornered the market. Apparently the BBC can't do it. Do a satire program because there's so many rules. You can't offend this person, that person. But so Murdoch, the private people, have stepped in now. This is, you know, it's appalling. It's disgusting. Murdoch is a Zionist. He's a fanatical pro-genocidalist. And so what we're doing is we're only allowing satire on the genocidal channels and not on the state media anymore. So anyway, let's have a listen to what Charlie had to say. This is just a clip from a longer interview I did with him. I started in this section. I asked him about this woman, Blaise Metrawelli, because she suddenly popped up on the scene as the Director General of the British Foreign Intelligence Services, MI6, Special Secret Intelligence Service, and she's there.
Somebody who has appeared on the updated list is Blaise Metrawelli. So we've got two very important Director Generals of the Intelligence Services of France and Britain. And I don't know if we've ever had top, you know, actually serving intelligence chiefs at the Bilderberg. They're usually ex-chiefs or people involved with intelligence.
Yeah, and there's also the head of the of that kind of intergovernmental agency, OSCE or whatever.
OECD, yeah, Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Yeah, as well as the World Economic Forum. So it's almost like all the other sub-Bilderbergs are all, the chiefs are all there.
Yeah, absolutely. And with obviously NATO's, the boss of NATO, plus his chief of staff, who I was reading up, is in charge of policy, NATO policy. So, and also the head of SHAPE, or have you, you know, if that's how you say it, I've never said that out loud, you know, the SHAPE.
Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, which I think was actually started in the Second World War, when the America after D-Day. Charlie, what I'd like is you just tell us what you think's going on, because we've obviously got this illegal, unprovoked Trump war, and Mark Carney and the Bilderbergers putting themselves up as the sensible people in the room.
Yeah, although Mark Carney on the fresh list?
No, he disappeared.
He was on the other one. But the most interesting, sorry, just to go back to the first list, is that the most interesting name to disappear, I think, is the head of the World Economic Forum, or the former head, Borga Brenda, or however he's called, or Brenda Borg, who left under a kind of shadow, a slight shadow of Epstein, a cloud of Epstein. And so he's been shuffled off the steering committee as well. Have you noticed? So the head of the World Economic Forum has stepped down and isn't here. And also, most interestingly, considering the Epstein links, Peter Thiel isn't on the new list.
Well, it was watermarked confidential. And so these are the sorts of people to warn journalists, please don't write about this. This is a press release marked confidential. These are the important people. And so when it's made public, they are not there, because this would make it more newsworthy, potentially. But anyway, how do you think the sort of Carney faction, the Bilderbergers, fit in with Trump's war?
Well, I mean, Rutter's there, currently, and has had his big slap on the wrist. Yet another from his daddy Trump, as he calls him, it's this very much a kind of mustering of the old guard, isn't it? You know, they're sort of putting on a kind of a show of concerted strength here, and saying, look, here we all are, here's all our bigwigs. But they're also with the American military here. You've got the Secretary of the Army and you've got the head of the Indo-Pacific Command here. So you've got big American military figures as well. There seems to be more unity behind the scenes than there are perhaps in front of the curtain.
Also, it's a very early meeting. I mean, we've been looking around to find it, and we weren't even expecting suddenly... Easter weekend, it pops up on the NATO website, of all places. We have a Bilderberg 6 weeks early.
It's very early. I mean, one can only assume that's to do with the various military shenanigans that are currently going on. I mean, there's the older... So it's interesting that the Greenland former foreign minister is there, is come. But so she was presumably invited when she was... But, you know, back a bit earlier when she was, because she left, I think she left office a couple of months ago or something. So she would be invited when she was the foreign minister. And still, they've honoured the invitation. She's here as the former foreign minister. And the whole Greenland thing was probably kind of put in the diary a bit earlier than, because, you know, it flared up a little while ago. And I think before all the latest stuff has kicked off. I mean, look, it's NATO seems to be sort of fighting on various fronts at the moment, and as you can see, as you go down the press release, you know, you've got you know, the Arctic security, which is a very interesting one. Speaking of Greenland, so that's that sort of area.
Yeah, that's code for Greenland.
Exactly. So, and that's a new. I've not seen that. I've not seen any reference to the Arctic in any previous Bilderberg, agenda. So that's very interesting. And but then obviously you've got the big hitters of the Middle East, you know, in Russia and Ukraine and all of that still, and Christian Freeland there talking about that.
Yeah, so just looking at the agenda, what do you think this is the purpose of this? I mean, I spoke earlier on to the Newsnight office, the production office in the BBC, saying it looks quite interesting. Would you not be interested in the story if it's been published on the Bilderberg website that the serving Director General of MI6 is over in Washington having a meeting about what to do about Trump underneath his nose?
Absolutely. I mean, it just says USA on the list. I like the way the list has things like...
Well, that's code for Trump.
Absolutely, that's code for Trump. It's also got the West, which is a slightly amazingly general, yet it's sort of interesting thing to have at the bottom, under the future of warfare. But also, it's got a few kind of strange ideological tags, like the West, and also... Transatlantic Defence Industrial Relationship, So that term, this transatlantic defense industrial term, is something that's sort of been knocking around since the late 90s, and it's come up, and I think it's there because the head of the IISS is there, Mark Sedwell, former cabinet secretary and former national security advisor, I think, of the UK. And so I think it's, I think that's, and that was, it's been one of their terms that they'd like to bandy around. So I suspect that's something he'll be, you know, hosting or talking about that.
Well, yeah, many people won't be familiar with the name Scott Bessant, but he's quite he's the US Secretary to the Treasury. He's there, as well as the guy from the National Security Council, the Money Men. So the Money Man at the US Treasury is there, plus the Money Man at the National Security Council, which means the War Council in America. So
you're operating off the old list. Bessant was on the old list, and they've changed it for the Secretary of the Interior. It's a different member of the. It's now Douglas Burgum, Secretary of the Interior, instead of they've swapped out Trump cabinet members. But you know, still got two of them there.
Okay, so if people have not come across this before, particularly journalists, that it takes maybe a few days to sink in, by which time the story's gone. What would you say about the significance or importance of this as a news story?
Well, it's bizarre. Look, I mean, I've been speaking to I'm working in a different realm at the moment. That is television comedy. And I've been speaking to people who are quite senior, quite well, one would say informed-ish, and they just don't know what I'm talking about. And I talk about this stuff, about it because it's just come out today, so I've been speaking to some people, and they don't know about it at all. It's, I would say, less than, you know, I don't want to tip my hat to the news-suppressing powers of Bilderberg, but it's just not a sort of commonly known thing. Like one might say, well, the G7's happening or something. I don't know, or a G8 or whatever. You know what I mean? Whereas, you know, eyes glaze over and confusion reigns when I talk about Bilderberg in a way that sort of hasn't happened for a while. And then it's happened again. So, yeah, my journey through Bilderberg seems to be from it being completely dismissed or thought of as almost not existing, through to almost mainstream acceptance. Now to it, they really sort of pulled it back out of the news cycle and I suspect that there's going to be very little coverage this year, which is incredible when you look at the list, which is so extraordinarily high powered. It really is, but every year it always slightly confuses me, but this year particularly, when you in all of this, with so much of the news focused on NATO and Trump and the wars, plural, then you have this crystallization of of all of these different realms, and you know, with the Trump administration here, NATO leaders, all of those things, and yet you know, it will, chances are, it'll just pass, sort of glide by, in sort of blissful silence.
Well, which is exactly what it's doing. I mean, we're right into this meeting. The all the Bilderberg participants were arriving yesterday afternoon and evening at Washington Airport, and some of them are being photographed. But no, not interesting. Martin, I think Charlie makes a point so well there that the issues which are being discussed are all over the news, but the place where the powerful people are discussing them is not.
Well, as you know, I mean, previously, Bilderberg was a very secretive organisation, to the extent of pretending it didn't exist at all. And then after a while, as you know, over the years, it became more into the public eye. But, of course, it's still regarded by mainstream people who are in mainstream jobs as, you know, it's the sort of thing cookie people look into. I mean, we don't do that sort of thing. As soon as they hear the word Bilderberg, they've been programmed, like Pavlov's dog, to think, oh, well, the people who talk about that are crazy people, so I don't talk about it. And, of course, that kind of groupthink is very powerful in any organisation.
To understand how it all works, I think you have to understand the press is printed on presses. The news is transmitted on transmitters, and somebody owns those transmitters. Somebody owns those presses. Somebody manages those editors and journalists, individuals at the top of these big news organizations, and including actually as well as universities that might be studying this but don't, that they all are actually owned by somebody nowadays. Particularly the commercial influence within academia is enormous now, and so it's like, well, we own you, so don't criticize us.
Well, that's right. I mean, the elite will have various ways of, you know, if you want to be in with the in crowd, certain things are expected of you. Yeah. Okay. So that, and you know, you'd be a fool to challenge that if you want to keep your job in, you know, well-paid jobs, but for the most part, as part of the structure.
So what do you make of this?
Not much mystery about why they don't cover it.
This notion I put to Dan, which is about the idea of actually the Bilderberg represents the Carney faction. He's an ex Peter Thiel faction, etc. But he's a great example of someone that many people know from the Bank of England, from his role on now as the Prime Minister of Canada. He was actually the boss of the Bank of Canada before he became the head of the Bank of England for many years. He did, I think, two terms as governor of the Bank of England. So he's somebody that's face is fairly well known around the world. And his faction is really an anti-Trump faction. So do you think it's fair to say that the Bilderberg meeting is convening to get together to discuss and decide what to do about Donald Trump, and actually that in a way, like I said, thank God for Bilderberg, somebody is actually getting together to counter this mania.
Well, I can see that is the interpretation that you are tending towards.
And I'm not. I'm just wondering, because this is a. I actually believe that personally.
Yes,
but you can see how this is how the Bilderbergers will be spinning this to all these participants who are lapping up their lovely conversations, their drinks, their food, their seminars, and all this sort of thing. And they'll be thinking to themselves, "I'm part of the sensible opposition to the maniacs."
Well, as Charlie pointed out, there are two Trump cabinet members in the meeting. So that, you know, Bessent didn't turn up. And that, you know, or he may be there, but we don't know he's there. Carney might be there and we don't know he's there. I don't think what they're really trying to do is keep elite consensus together. So even people, you know, plenty of people in the elite are not happy with Trump for various reasons, but what they don't want is to remove Trump and then lose control of the situation. So what they'd be talking about, how can we, you know, get Trump to do what we want in the way that we want him to do it rather than the way that he wants him to do it. And of course, the real underlying stuff is not even about Trump. It's about the war itself. What are we going to do when the oil price goes to $200 next year? Because it's going to crash loads of businesses. Well, the AI bubble may burst. We've got all these AI geniuses in there. They could be bankrupt by this time next year. They need to discuss that.
Do you think they will? No.
If they ought to, because they might end up with nothing.
Surely if this was all left to AI, the world would be a much better place.
The problem with AI, as you well know, is that it doesn't actually work. It's one of these technologies that's unproven, and it's totally dependent on the Gulf of Hormuz. They really do need all those
straits. Yeah, the straits, yeah.
Yeah, they need it all. And the AI bubble has been pretty sort of ropey recently. Even senior people, Jamie Dimon and all these other people, saying, well, it could be a bubble, blah, blah, blah. But if what carries on now, carries on, and it's pretty much guaranteed to carry on now, that we're definitely going to have some kind of recession, that may pop the AI bubble. In which case, what are all these people going to do for a living? We'll have to get down the job centre.
Well, when it comes to a ceasefire, it's annoying, isn't it, when the petrol prices go up and the diesel prices go up 50 pence a litre, but then they don't come down again. And I was just looking earlier on at the Welsh farmer, Gwynwyn Jones or something. Can't remember his first name. But anyway, he's put a protest. There's going to be later this month, protests across this country. We've got fuel price protests going on right now in Ireland with the police being called, etc., as the fuel distribution depots are blockaded. Now, obviously, that isn't going to help distribute the fuel, but it's a protest. The whole point is that our own governments, and represented by several of the Bilderbergers, the Irish government are there, etc., they're doing almost nothing to alleviate the cost of living crisis going skyrocketing by these massive fuel prices. Now, these fuel prices, as you know, will be having a massive knock-on effect in the next few months through food prices, even like gas and electricity prices, all these sorts of things there will be runaway inflation, possibly runaway. This is affecting everybody in these countries, but what I'm saying is that our governments don't really seem to be standing up to the Americans or the Israelis at all.
Well, let's just say that the real danger is not runaway inflation. What will happen is the oil price will go up, and that will deflate the rest of the economy. What we're looking at is a crash, possibly. That's what Hudson and Keane were talking about the other week, and they're people I rate.
So it'll get to a sort of cliff edge and go boom.
Yeah, because the oil price gets beyond a certain level. That is obviously creates inflation.
Well, what happens is people will take all of their wealth out of the stock market. They'll say, well, this is not the place anymore.
That's right.
I'm going to put it... Where would they put it? In commodities?
The gold price has been going up for quite a long time. But, of course, that is also a problem because it's not real gold. So
What? Isn't it?
Well, a lot of people are buying pieces of paper that says you are entitled to so much gold, but that might not actually work for them.
That sounds like cash. It sounds like, well, exactly. I promised to pay the bearer.
Well, that's what the pound sterling used to be. It used to be based on gold.
Well, I think there are places that you can actually own the physical gold.
Yes, there is.
Like the Bank of England runs one.
Yes, example. I know, but I mean, there's all sorts of... I mean, you know, we could go into the whole question.
So the point is,
the
stock market is like a kind of casino. People love it because they can make such a lot of money, and if it got insider information. But there may come a point where the stock market is simply not able to. I mean, maybe the only thing that might be left is the military shares might be going up, but everything else going down.
Yeah, well, that's it. That's what will happen. That's likely to happen. And, of course, they need to discuss how they're going to manage that. As your contributor from Washington was saying earlier,
Dan,
they may be planning what they're going to do when the crash happens. Yeah, one of the things that they might be able to do is to dump the blame for the crash on the Iranians. You know, so they could be discussing how they could dump
or the Russians.
When you say the Russians, that's quite interesting. There's an obvious solution to the cost of living crisis here in Europe and in Britain, which is to reopen the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, make friends with the Russians, and get lots of cheap. And of course, the Spanish, who've said that they will not allow the US to use their military bases, their ships taking oil and gas to Spain will go through the Straits of Hormuz.
Oh.
That's right, because that's what the Iranians are doing. Ooh. If you're nice to us, you can have the stuff. If you're not, you can't.
Yeah,
that's an obvious challenge to Starmer, because Sanchez has basically taken a fairly strong line, and the Iranians appreciate that.
You know,
and they're not even charging the Spanish a fee to
send their
interesting.
Their stuff. You look
through
at the coverage. I go to places like newsnow.co.uk to look. There's only one article out there, and that's a Polish one behind a firewall. But yesterday, the only one was in the Spanish newspaper are writing about Bilderberg. They're talking about it, but none of the other NATO countries are.
No, because Spain is now, you know, Spain's got a different political history from Britain for obvious reasons. Sanchez was under quite a lot of pressure at one stage, but they've got a proportional system, so he has to, in order to remain in power,
he's got a coalition, hasn't he?
He's got a coalition.
Including communists.
Including the Communist Party and others, yes. And therefore, it actually is in his interests to keep those people on board. And, of course, the general population in Spain is much more politically switched on than they are in this country because of the Civil War. Their grandparents are buried in mass graves where they were tortured and killed by Franco. So, in actual fact, the modern Socialist Party, Communist Party, the anarchists even in Barcelona and places like that, they've got a political history which makes them suspicious of NATO at all. I mean, you know, Spain, the Madrid Agreement in 1954, Franco came into NATO. He allowed the US to have bases there and so on. Now, all of that means that in actual fact, there's a lot of historical grudge towards the Western powers by the ordinary population in Spain. And they've just got more of a history of this stuff. And, of course, it's not doing Sanchez any harm politically. Yeah, he's actually strengthened his position politically because Vox, who are the far right in Spain, they came out in support of Trump and so on, and that's cost them votes, cost them support.
Mm. Good.
Because the guy's a total maniac and he's a total liar. And he's in bed with the genocidaires, isn't he, Mr. Netanyahu? I like the body language when Trump is with Netanyahu. It's almost as if Netanyahu knows he's in control. It's like, I've shown him this Epstein clip and he's going to do everything I say. Ha ha. And they get this little Netanyahu smirk. But anyway, the whether or not the United States has just simply been used, prostituted to Israel to attack Iran, which is one of the things they've always wanted to do, well, for at least for the last 30, 40 years. Since the 1979 revolution, I suppose. So there are people who are now saying, well, we're going to hear from one of them in a minute, that Trump has actually been humiliated in this attack over the last few weeks, the attack on Iran, and he won't be able to do it again.
Well, I mean, the military analysis I've been reading suggests that, you know, I'm also reading a book about military incompetence in history. And just because you want to do something doesn't mean you've got either the capacity or the skills to do it. And the Iranians have been preparing for this fight for decades. They've quietly got on with preparing themselves. And it turns out that their preparations have been ideal for what they want to do. And the idea that Trump can just pull a rabbit out of a hat. You know, don't forget, he never fought in Vietnam, like, and many of them didn't do, because, you know, if you're a wealthy elite, you don't have to fight anybody. You never have to sacrifice anything, are you?
Okay, well, let's have a listen to the Israeli Jewish commentator, Norman Finkelstein.
Trump went into this war because he thought it would be another moment, and maybe a shining moment, of grandeur for him. It was very personalized. He had those seeming victories in Gaza where he quote-unquote ended the war, thought he'd win the Nobel Prize for it, and then the immaculate coup in Venezuela. So now he was suffering from a certain, you might call it, excess of hubris. And then he had two major defeats. He had the defeats in Greenland, where he said he's taking Greenland, no question about it, no discussion, no debate, and it ended up being a debacle. And then he had the defeat in Minnesota domestically when he said ICE was going to take over. It didn't. He had to leave. He had to retreat in Minnesota. So after those two defeats, he wanted to restore his grandeur. It was a very personalized, the decision to go into Iran, even though it wasn't contrary to U.S. national interests, it was still a very personalized decision. Trump, having been told by the Israelis it would be a cakewalk, Iran was on the precipice, all it needed was a little jolt, and it would fall over. He believed it. And there the Israelis did play, in my opinion, a critical role, because Trump assembled an administration of sub-mediocre yes-men. But the thing is, he knew they were sub-mediocre yes-men. In fact, that's why he chose them. And so he didn't trust their judgment. He didn't defer to them. That was unusual. Now, Cheney and Rumsfeld did trust their judgment and did ignore others, but that's because they had very good judgment. They were wrong in the case of Iraq, but in general, they were extremely competent, very smart, and very conscientious in their service to the national interest as they perceived it. Trump just had sub-mediocre yes men, and so he deferred to the Israeli judgment. The Israelis, you might say, they filled the informational void. The informational void that Trump himself had created when he appointed people like Hegseth and Rubio and ambassadors like Witkoff and Kushner. And so I do believe the Israelis tipped the balance. They tipped the balance by telling Trump that he would emerge a triumphant figure like Caesar or Napoleon. Trump believed it. And they tipped the balance when they told him it would be a cakewalk. Exactly, by the way, what Rumsfeld and Cheney thought in 2003, that it would be a cakewalk. So my opinion is, because it's so personalized, Trump, the national interest is there, but it's not his priority. He won't do it again. It was a disaster. It's exactly what happened with Greenland. Once Greenland did not turn out the way he hoped, it was forgotten. How many people talk about Greenland now? Now, do you remember it was in the top of the news for weeks? It was just, he just walks away. He doesn't care. He's basically an agent of chaos. He will find another place to create chaos because, of course, as a megalomaniac, he loves the headlines. So, loves to be in the limelight. So he will just, in my opinion, it didn't turn out as he thought it would, just like Greenland didn't. He'll just walk away and forget about it.
So, well, I wonder, love Norman Finkelstein, his take, Martin, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's fairly accurate. I mean, don't disagree with any of that.
So is he committed to regime change in Iran, or was this just an attempt to make some sort of big splash on the world stage for a narcissist?
The Israelis were committed to a regime change in Iran, and it's the head of Mossad, Murat, I can't remember his name, Barney, I can't remember the name of the guy. He was the one who persuaded Trump to go ahead. And
Will Trump learn and not trust this guy again?
Well, the point is, it doesn't matter whether he learns, because what he's already done is potentially out of control. We may be already path dependent in chaos.
I love what he said about the sub-mediocre advisors and the information void. This idea that you're actually surrounded by idiots.
You can imagine.
Do you remember Gary O'Donnell? We played the clip on this show about 6 months ago from the BBC. Interviewed Donald Trump about Putin. He said, "Do you trust Putin?" And there was a pause, and Trump says, "Well, I don't really trust anyone."
Well, that's right, because he's got all sorts. I mean, obviously, people have been psychoanalyzing
Trump.
He's managed
to surround himself, or he has been surrounded.
I saw a thing about his mother, who years ago was in the newspaper with a picture of him and his mother. His mother said, "He's my boy, but he's basically a narcissist and an idiot, and I hope he never goes into politics." And he's there grinning in the background.
Well, you know what,
that's his mum. His mum said that.
Hegseth's mum said something similar about him.
Yeah. People should listen to their mums. Maybe that's the answer to this.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Maybe your mum's right.
Maybe we should swap these world leaders for their mums. And we're living in a much more sensible place. So anyway, I'll put a full version of that fascinating little chat with Norman Finkelstein up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. So do you think Trump is now going to leave Iran alone?
Well, no, because they can't. I mean, what they ought to do is say, "We've got all this completely wrong. We need to withdraw from the Middle East. Israel needs to get back behind its 1948 borders, and we should do lots of business deals." But that's not going to happen, because the whole structure of Western power is to control oil in the Middle East in order to try and dominate the world economy, and they can't just opt out of that. They've probably, just like Nazi Germany wanted to take over the whole of Europe, why can't we just get on with it? What's the problem for you in America? but they won't back down because they can't. They've just got to be defeated, and then they'll be made to back down.
Well as his extraordinary pronouncements, Donald Trump, about ending civilization in Iran, thousands of years of Persian culture and history, hinting that he was going to nuke them, basically. This is his art of the deal. Let's have a listen to him talking about what he's going to do to journalists, because over this... this debacle over Easter weekend, with where this there is this, these two narratives, one saying that the Americans tried to go into the middle of Iran, put their special forces forward base, the whole thing was a total disaster on the one hand, and the other narrative, which has been coming out through the Western press, saying that they went there to rescue an airman and heroically they brought him back, even though he hasn't
Saving Private Ryan
yet appeared. Yes, like a film script or something. Now, I mean, I'm inclined to agree to believe the first, although it's very difficult to know in these the days of information warfare. One thing you can be sure is when they need the mainstream media to tell the story they want to tell, the mainstream media will bend over for them. Of course they will. So let's have a listen now to Donald Trump himself talking about what he thinks he's going to do to journalists that leak information.
These two extraordinary rescues, because it was two, and as you probably know, we didn't talk about the first one for an hour. Then somebody leaked something, which we'll hopefully find that leaker. We're looking very hard to find that leaker, and talked about there's somebody missing. They basically said that we have one and there's somebody missing. Well, they didn't know there was somebody missing until this leaker gave the information. So whoever it is, we think we'll be able to find it out, because we're going to go to the media company that released it, and we're going to say, national security, give it up or go to jail. And we know who, and you know who we're talking about, because some things you can't do, because when they did that, all of a sudden, the entire country of Iran knew that there was a pilot that was somewhere on their land that was fighting for his life, and it also made it much more difficult for the pilots and for the people going in to search for him. All of a sudden, they know that there's somebody out there, they see all these planes coming in, it became a much more difficult operation. Because a leaker leaked that we have one, we've rescued one, but there's another one out there that we're trying to get. So actually, the country, Iran, put out a major notice, you all saw it, offering a very big award for anybody that captures the pilot. So in addition to a hostile, very talented, very good, very evil military, we had millions of people trying to get an award. So when you add that to it, but we have to find that leaker, because that's a sick person. Probably didn't realize the extent of how bad it was. I can't imagine that the person did, but we're going to find out. It's national security, and the person that did the story will go to jail if he doesn't say, and that doesn't last long, and I think everybody would understand it. They put this mission at great risk. They put that man at great risk, and they put the hundreds of people that went in looking for him, because everyone now knows that we're going in.
Well, hang on a minute. It's not national security, Martin, is it? The number of crew members on an F-15. Everyone knows it. It's two people. So if they've said, we've rescued one, then everybody will know just by a bit of addition or subtraction that there's another one still out there.
Yeah, unless they were dead.
Well, the Iranians were on the scene, so they knew that the aircraft, there's nobody in the aircraft, there's no dead bodies in the aircraft, Americans have rescued one, if they did, and there must be another one, mustn't there?
Yes, and I think what Trump's talking about there is, presumably, he's saying that it was reported in the media that there was another person missing. Now, it should be quite straightforward to track down which media outlet said that, and he's what he's doing.
Well, the American press said that they'd rescued one. Right, so it's obvious. This is my point. I mean, I may be wrong about this, but it seems obvious to me that there's going to be another one. You know, there's two people flying in an F-15. These are very old, 1970s, I think, 1980, roughly, they were introduced. Everybody knows you have two crew members. If you've got one, there's going to be another one left if there's no dead body in the plane.
Yes, I get your point, but presumably what Trump is hinting at there, I haven't looked into it properly, is that some media outlets in the US gave out the information that there was a second person.
Well, maybe like you and I, we're sitting here going, oh, well, they've got one. There's two crew members in an F-15. Maybe there's still another one there.
Yeah, so in other words, Trump
this is national security.
Trump is suggesting there that somebody inside the structure leaked the information. So we're going after the leaker. Now, the leaker isn't the journalist.
Maybe you've just got a journalist with a brain cell.
Well, indeed. But the point is that what he's doing is threatening the press there.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to report things.
The fake news. No. We're not fake news, mate.
Well,
we're actually journalists.
Let's just take a step back. Maybe the whole story about going into rescue people who've been shot down is a red herring anyway.
Yeah.
Maybe none of it happened. In actual fact, what we're talking about is a failed, like Operation Eagle Claw in 1979 to rescue the US hostages. It turned into a catastrophe in the same sort of circumstances as this one has turned into a catastrophe. And therefore, that's really bad for Trump because it makes him look worse than Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, he's not coming out of this smelling of roses at all. Neither is the American empire collapsing, isn't it? Anyway, so another person who's had an interesting, obviously, Judge Napolitano is like the creme de la creme in many of the commentators because he has some of the very best people on. One of them is Max Blumenthal from the Grey Zone, and he thinks that actually much of what's going on, he agrees with Norman Finkelstein about the Israeli influence at the White House.
No, there's not a ceasefire, and it looks to me, having lived through the last 3 years and seeing how pauses in, for example, the Gaza genocide were exploited for Israel to remobilize and rearm, that we're witnessing something similar as U.S. Marines are being deployed to the region. And as Israel was on the verge of running out of interceptors and Iran had really consolidated its momentum, the United States, via Pakistan, attempted to create the impression of a ceasefire. Now, this allowed Donald Trump to game the markets, and we're seeing that some White House insider has placed a close to $1 billion bet on the price of Brent crude going down as Donald Trump sent oil prices tumbling with his announcement of his acceptance of Iran's National Security Council's 10-point plan as a baseline for discussions and negotiations. But the more revealing part of this ceasefire was how the United States government, looks like the State Department, had provided Pakistan's Shahbaz Sharif, Pakistan's leader, with the framework or the terms that were agreed upon for the ceasefire as a draft. And Sharif, or someone in his office, posted the draft, including the header that said terms for Sharif. And then they edited the tweet on X, but everyone could see that he had basically been fed these terms. These terms explicitly included Lebanon as part of the ceasefire. So the United States had agreed to include Lebanon. Iran had agreed to include Lebanon through Pakistan. So what does Israel do? Commits one of the worst massacres in history in Lebanon, massacring over 250 people, wounding over 1,200 people. There are families lining up outside hospitals to identify the bodies of over 90 people today. They were bombing not just the Dahiya section of Beirut, which is the Shia majority area where Hezbollah has had some offices, and they can always justify mass destruction and killings of civilians on that basis that it's majority Shia. They were bombing areas like Ain Mersi, the Corniche in the center of Beirut, areas where opponents of Hezbollah live. They killed a famous Lebanese poet and her husband. Entire families were killed inside their homes. They bombed a funeral in a cemetery with a 500-pound bomb. The entire purpose of this was to sabotage the ceasefire and to provoke Iran into defending its ally in Lebanon. And what does the White House go and do? Including J.D. Vance, the so-called restrainer. J.D. Vance said, oh, well, those terms, they were actually AI. That was all AI-generated slop.
So that's Max Blumenthal on Judge Knapp making some really good points. He thinks this is just a little pause. Trump is probably going to do something similar again. He's moving troops over there. I think it was on antiwar.com earlier seeing that US military will stay near Iran, ready for the next conquest, says Donald Trump. So time is running out for the US to honour the truce, though, says Iran. So anyway, what about this point that maybe they're just running out of Patriot missiles and they think, oh, hang on, we better stop?
Well, that's a fundamental point. Of course it is. What the Iranians have been doing is they've been using all this old stuff from the 1980s and 1990s to get them to, so that they waste all of their high-tech. Their high-tech stuff is designed to fight a naval battle in the Pacific against another fleet. It's not designed to do anything, you know, so that you send a $10,000 drone up there and they have to shoot it down with a $250,000 missile. And of course, you've got hundreds and hundreds of these drones, and that $250,000 missile is there to fight, you know, it's another $250,000 missile fired from another naval ship. So they've just totally got the wrong equipment for the battle they're fighting. So they've got to try and find another way to, I mean, for Trump's PR people are trying to find a way to make it sound as if he knows what he's doing and that this is all a very clever game to try and get what we want, blah, de blah. But of course, increasingly, it's not. It just isn't, is it?
Philip Giraldi is somebody who is an ex-CIA, isn't he? Yeah, so here he is responding to, and by the way, various of these clips, I'll put the long versions up with Max and Norman Finkelstein later on. And what I will do is let's have a listen now to Philip Giraldi talking about this whole business of Trump's threat to destroy an entire civilization.
The first reaction was, of course, I wasn't surprised because Trump is has basically been this way ever since he's been in the White House, and so I kind of expected that trash talking from Donald Trump would be the norm. I was quite outraged by the fact that he was doing this on Easter. I mean, this is a guy who I don't know what his religiosity is, but he certainly has some strange people hanging around him. And this is not the Christian thing to be doing. So I was completely outraged by that. And I hoped like hell somebody would lower the boom on him, call him in. And how about a little impeachment going on here, buddy?
Well, what was your reaction to the follow-up in which he threatened to destroy the Iranian civilization?
That was even worse. I mean, because that's going public. He's the chief spokesman for the United States of America, of which we are citizens, and he's speaking for us, and he's guaranteeing not just a genocide, but a genocide, if he was the way he was phrasing it, it's something to kill like millions, multiple millions of people. Innocent people in most cases. And this is what he was talking about. So he was obviously implying, I think, that he just might be using nuclear weapons to do the job.
Well, I agree. That's what I thought when I heard that phrase, Martin.
Yeah, and I suppose what he could do is finesse it by saying, I'm just going to destroy all of their power plants and their factories, you know, because that's what he was talking about. We're going to start attacking their oil.
Well, they keep talking about bombing people back to the Stone Age. This has become a normal thing now, hasn't it?
You see, one of the things, without nuclear weapons, what could easily happen this week or next week is that all of the oil infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, Iran, Kuwait, Qatar, all of it can be destroyed pretty quickly. Yeah, and it can't be rebuilt in any short run. So that really will bake in a full-on depression, global depression. which will kill millions of people indirectly. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a nuclear weapon that he was talking about. But of course, what he had to back down on is in actual fact, to destroy Iran's physical infrastructure is quite difficult. It's a big country. It's what the biggest power stations they've got only produce about 3% of the electricity. So that even if you knock out a whole power station, you've only knocked out 3% of the electricity. That's not true of Israel, for example. They've only got a few power stations that they can be knocked out. So in other words, there is an imbalance there in the situation, which is making it very difficult for them to proceed. Although there have been attacks on the nuclear facility, Bushehr, somebody's been attacking it, the Israelis have been attacking it. Which, of course, if they hit it, all of the radiation from that will actually blow over the Gulf states. Now, don't forget, from the Israeli point of view, they don't necessarily like the Gulf states particularly, and they're quite happy to see them destroyed. Because, of course, the physical nature of Doha and all these other places and Dubai is very, very vulnerable. You know, people hadn't thought about it. You know, the wealthy of the world go to live in Dubai because it's got low taxes, nice weather. You know, you can do what you like.
If you take out a couple of desalination plants, that's right.
If you've got no water to drink, you can't survive more than 48 hours in that part of the world. Yeah, that's what it used to be like. So it's very vulnerable. And the other thing that crossed my mind when he was talking about he's going to destroy civilization is like when Croesus sent to the oracle at Delphi said, if I attack Persia, what will happen? And the oracle at Delphi said, well, the great civilization will fall. And so Croesus then attacked Persia, and the great civilization that fell was his own one. Yeah. Now, there's two possibilities here. The civilization that might fall is the West, because this is what's at stake here, because the Russians and the Chinese aren't directly implicated. They've got plenty of ways to get out of this. Or the other thing is destroy everybody. Yeah, civilization to court, including British civilization.
Mm. Yes, thank you, Donald. But I mean, of course, it is those around him, and Norman Finkelstein, absolutely right. He surrounded himself by these like worm tongue whisperers. So what about the Iranians? We haven't heard from them yet. Mohammed Mirandi, here he is, on Chinese TV, English language TV.
People are very happy to see that the United States has backed down from its foolish position. Remember, at the beginning, it called for Iran to capitulate. It said total, complete surrender. And then it had to change its position. And finally, it gave a 15-point plan that Iran rejected. And then came the Iranian plan. And the United States agreed that this would be the framework for negotiations. Now, that Iran is not naive, and Iranians are not naive. We don't expect this to be smooth sailing at all. But the point is that after 40 days, the regime in Washington and its allies and those who were complicit in this war and the Israeli regime recognize that Iran is very powerful.
All right.
For 40 days, Iran has been firing missiles day and night, and the Iranian people have been steadfast. I'm sure you've seen the people on the streets every night. And that, I think, is something that shocked the Americans and made them recognize that Iran is very different from any other adversary that they've tried to destroy over the past few decades.
There will be a lot of supplies of all kinds in the region by the U.S., and it's going to be quite a scene, according to the U.S. president. Now, how do you see the points being indicated by the U.S. president? What does that mean to the Iranians?
He says one thing one day and something else the next day, and a lot of the things that he says just doesn't make sense. Iran will not be partners with the United States in managing the Strait of Hormuz. Iran has told Oman that they are prepared for partnership, and the two sides are negotiating on how to carry this forward. But we are very far away from normalization. I should add something, and that is that Lebanon is a part of the ceasefire. And this is something that the Pakistani prime minister has also confirmed openly. Mm. And the Israeli regime wants the ceasefire to fail. That's why they're carrying out mass slaughters. But with regards to the Strait of Hormuz, there are technical issues. After all, the United States has destroyed Iran's naval, many of Iran's naval installations, at least those that are on the surface, on the ground. And there is a huge buildup of ships. But also, I think the Iranians are going to use the Strait of Hormuz to make sure that the United States does not use this period as an opportunity to attack Iran again. Mm. Remember, and I'm sure you do, we were negotiating with the Americans 9 months ago, and they were secretly conspiring to attack us. Right. And then before this war started, we were negotiating. There was progress. The Omani foreign minister said there was significant progress, and then they attacked us again. Yeah. So the Iranians want to make sure that the United States is not in a strong position where it can just suddenly turn and strike us again in the coming days or weeks.
Yeah, that's Mohamed Mirandi speaking on China TV. Martin, do you think he's right? Do you think they have managed to put the Americans in that position where they can't do the same again?
I think they have, which is why, of course, they've been... some of the commentary I've been reading on the internet is saying, well, why are the Iranians agreeing to anything? I think they're agreeing from a position of strength.
Yeah.
They know that it will look good in the rest of the world if, even after everything that's happened, they go the extra mile. And I think the Chinese have had some influence there, because the Chinese are major allies of the Iranians and the Russians. And they do, you know, it's in their interest for this to be settled without a full fight. So, and I think the Iranians need to keep their own population on side. They need to appeal to people like us. Yeah. And of course, they're trying to make sure that if the economy goes down, global economy goes down, they don't get the blame. Yep. So I can see why they're doing it. In any case, as somebody outside Iran, I don't think I'm in a position to tell them whether they should or shouldn't negotiate. It's absolutely up to them. If they don't want to negotiate, that's absolutely within their, you know, within their rights to say, no, we're not talking to you. And if they do decide to negotiate, it's not for me to tell them not to.
When you talk there about the role of the Pakistanis in all of this, seems to have been very important. And we also heard, didn't we, about this idea of the message from the Pakistani leader being just literally cut and pasted from an American diplomatic cable.
Yes, but I think the military government in Pakistan, which is what it is also very dependent on the Chinese. So I think that in fact is probably the vector that's been chosen to try and have some kind of discussion. But as I understand it, I checked the internet before I came out this evening. The Iranians have said, well, they're not going to Islamabad for a meeting. They're just not going.
Well, this is a perfect time to have a chat with Adil Raja then. He's a former Pakistani tank regiment officer, third generation, who was also the spokesperson for the Pakistan Veterans Association. He's now in exile in London, but he's chatting to everyone that will listen. And as part of this interview, I did also ask him to give us an update on the attacks that took place on him and his home and his colleagues, physical attacks, in this country, which have been dealt with by the Met Police and the counter-terrorism police. But what we're going to hear from now is a bit of his analysis from a military point of view, what's been happening over the last few weeks.
Trump has himself fallen into the escalation trap in the case of Iran war. And the trap was laid for him by none other but his beloved Bibi Netanyahu, who went to the White House, and ultimately President Trump himself had to tell it. You know, he has to tell the tale. And he told everyone that it was Benjamin Netanyahu who came to the Situation Room of the White House, and who said that, listen, you go and attack Iran, and within a couple of weeks, the Iranian military would be degraded. They won't be able to fight back. The nuclear capability would be destroyed completely. They won't, you know, be counterattacking, and Strait of Hormuz won't be closed. None of that, you know, was true. And we are in day 42, 43, and exactly the opposite happened. Iran's capabilities have been damaged severely, but they are still sustaining a counterattack. Their strategy of fighting this war, which was started by Israel and USA, was never to defend themselves. That's why they've taken the hit in their home inside Iran. But they have been continuously attacking the U.S. military bases with highly accurate intelligence and very, very well-guided systems. The drone attacks and the ballistic missiles attacks have been continuously going on. They've been reduced. They've been their military capabilities have been clearly damaged, but they are still able to sustain an attack and to attack the Gulf countries and the U.S. bases. And you're given the example of Prince Sultan base in Saudi Arabia. They are attacking Israel, and they are attacking at will. And there have been precision strikes on drone factories in Israel, military facilities in Israel, and the so-called Iron Dome system has, it has been exhausted. The air defense system of U.S. itself, the Patriot defense system, has been exhausted. Why? Because the Iranians are fighting a 21st century war, and the U.S. war machine is designed to fight a 20th century war. I mean, if you're shooting down a $20,000 drone with a 4 million Patriot missile, so who is winning actually, even if the drone does not hit its target? And now, once you are intercepting these missiles, so the debris of the interceptor is coming down to the targets, and the targets are highly combustible. And for example, the gas facilities, the oil and gas facilities, they catch fire very easily. So strategically speaking, tactically, the U.S. and Israel are winning fine. Strategically speaking, strategically, Iran is the winner in this war. Strategically, because they have been able to sustain the attack with the Chinese support, of course, and with the Russian intelligence support, of course.
We're not getting to see a lot of this on the mass media in the West. We're not getting to see. But there was distribution by the Saudis of all these photographs of the destroyed AWACS. Now, one of those will cost you almost $1 billion. It was completely ruined by the Iranians. And this is unprecedented for the Saudis to actually release the photos.
That's true. But the Saudis released their photo because President Trump, in his usual style, because he wasn't happy with Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He went ahead and he said, "He kissed my ass." He was kissing my ass. And previously there were articles planted that he wanted us to go and attack Iran, and he wants us to continue. Whereas, yes, they were party to it, but it was the Israelis who went after Iran and who asked President Trump to go and attack them. So, obviously, and once the Saudis did not want to openly engage with the Iranians, and that was the design all along, to make it a sectarian dispute and make it a Shia-Sunni dispute and make all the Arab kingdoms fight Iran, whereas they've been paying trillions of dollars to the U.S. to defend them. So it's U.S. job, they think, to defend them because they've paid them the money. So seesaw situation, I would say, President Trump made those remarks that, Prince Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, was kissing my ass, So in response, the very next day, the pictures of billions of dollars of loss of this highly sophisticated planes, which are totally foreign number in U.S. military, the destruction of one of that AWACS system, AWACS plane, was issued in the high definition, high definition pictures were released. So yeah, I would believe, the repercussions of President Trump's remarks about Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
So it just shows you, doesn't it? You say rude things about Prince Salman, he's going to release a load of pictures of your burnt, smashed up airplanes on the ground.
Well, manners cross nothing, Tony. And that's what Trump's mum told him years ago. Manners cost nothing.
It is quite significant, though, isn't it, that we're not being shown a lot of this damage. I mean, as Adil's saying there, there's loads of damage to the US military facilities across the Gulf states, but we're not being shown it on the television here.
No, we're not.
Or the radio, or the newspapers. And actually, it's quite... I think in the incursion, the so-called rescue of the airmen, there's 10 US aircraft lost. Yeah. The Iranians released pictures of, like, a whole field of mass burnt-out aircraft. Now, the Americans say that we actually burnt up our... destroyed our own aircraft because we couldn't actually fly them out. They got stuck in the mud.
Well, that's... I mean, the point
Who do
about...
you believe?
Well, the point about this is that the US have now got, and the Israelis, have now got a reputation for making stuff up and lying. Now, it's okay, you can, in fact, pull the wool over people's eyes and pull tricks on them by lying and dissembling. But once you get a reputation for being a liar and a dissembler, even when you're telling the truth, people don't believe you. So in actual fact, I discount everything that they say. It's virtually all of it just made up.
Well,
whereas the Iranians, on the other hand, by and large,
and the Russians,
the way you do war propaganda is you don't lie. You just don't tell the whole truth.
You know, it's the same, wasn't it, between Nazi Germany and Britain in the Second World War, although there was a bit of lying on both sides, I'm sure. We had the confidence in London that that we could allow the German lies to be broadcast. There was Radio Luxembourg, Lord Haw Haw. I've said this many times, but he was allowed to broadcast on medium wave right the way through the war until Luxembourg was overrun by the Allies. And there was no attempt to block it because the British knew that we had the confidence that we knew that we would lampoon the lies that were being told by Lord Haw Haw, and that it's almost like the whole situation has now been reversed, where it's us that don't want to hear, we don't want our populations in the West to hear what the Iranians are saying. They banned press TV, which you and I have been on. They banned RT, which you and I have both been on, and there's just no confidence over here because they don't want other narratives to be allowed, including things like these photographs of the smashed up, burnt out American billions of dollars of jets.
Well, they've also, because of the obsession with narrative and psychological warfare, they've got the idea that they need to make a better film script. That all they're missing here is a better script writer.
They got a great script for the guy who was rescued from the plane.
Exactly, but the point is, once you've become and don't forget the internet, however imperfectly, does create a check on all of these things. You know, anybody listening to this show, for example, either now or later, will have much better information about what's going on than if they're following the mainstream.
The owners of the mainstream press, I was talking about the transmitter, the printing press owners, they think, oh, it's okay, well, it's, you know, they can marginalise the truth by letting people like us get on and tell it, and they know that hardly anyone will hear it.
Well, they don't forget that we've also had people trying to stop us doing UK lawyers for Israel did indeed try to close us down.
Yeah, but then it's actually...
why would they bother?
Well, actually, we must be annoying them to some extent. What then happened was the station manager closed us down.
Yes, I know. So in other words...
A man called Patrick Hart, who's now working at the BBC, I hear.
Yes, but the point is that by doing that, they ultimately saw off the branch they're sitting on, because everybody eventually works out that this is just you making stuff up. You know, I mean, you know, some people just automatically tell fibs, and eventually people work out that they're just talking, that that's what they do, and everybody makes allowances for it, don't they?
We shall overcome. We shall
truth will make us free.
today. We are not afraid. We are not afraid. We are not afraid today. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall
let us pray to the Father who is present with us to eternity, that our risen Saviour may fill us and all Christian believers with the joy of his glorious and life-giving resurrection. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. That isolated and persecuted churches may find fresh strength in the good news of Easter. We pray especially for those parts of the world where their celebrations are diminished due to fear. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. That God may grant us humility to be subject to one another in Christian love, that all people of goodwill work to provide dignity to those who lack food, work, or shelter. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. That by his power, war and famine may cease throughout all the world, that the human family may care for creation and for each other. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. That he may reveal the light of his presence to the sick, the weak, and the dying, to comfort and strengthen them. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. That according to his promises, all who have died in the faith of the resurrection may rejoice in eternal life. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. That he may send forth the fire of the Holy Spirit upon his people, so that we may bear true and faithful witness to his resurrection. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. Heavenly Father, you have delivered us from the power of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of your Son. Grant that, as his death has recalled us to life, so his continual presence in us may raise us to eternal joy. Through Christ our Lord. Amen. we sum up all our prayers in the words of the grace. The grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, and the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit, be with us all, evermore. Amen.
so that final one there's from the 1980s. That's Fire of Unknown Origin is the album. The band is the Blue Oyster Cult. That's a veteran of the Psychic Wars. I particularly like that because it seems to be, and I may be wrong, but it seems to be making allusions, 1981 that came out, to Michael Moorcock and this kind of mythos that he creates in his novels to do with the Lords of Law and the Lords of Chaos. And the Lords of Chaos seem to be manifesting right now in Washington, D.C. So I suppose that makes the Bilderbergers the Lords of Law, maybe. And so before that we had, I think it was, it was Coral Evensong from Salford, on Radio 3 on every Wednesday. Some lovely stuff from there, a bit of music too. And then at the very start we had 1963. Joan Byers up at the BBC singing We Shall Overcome. So welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. So the whole point of the second part, I think, at least this is what I'm aiming to do, is to try to look at the core of the horror story that we've seen over the last few weeks and the potential for destruction to mankind that represents, and to start to really focus down and zoom in on the whole Israel-Palestine situation, the spiritual situation. I was helped very much because last week I got a message from Moeen Yassin over in Istanbul at Global Vision 2000 to say he was putting together an emergency eschatology conference. Now, this is on contemporary diabolism. So he's very much looking at this from a point of view of studying evil, which is one of the things we do on this program, and particularly looking at Zionism. We'll be doing a bit of that in the end of this. I suppose one of the ways to start is by just simply looking at the Israelis today. I mean, what on earth is going on with Israel? Frightening. It's had since the late 1940s, they've been educating children to see themselves as the victims, even though, of course, they are committing genocide. They're killing. So there's something very, very bad going on with the Zionists. And Abby Martin, who people might remember from RT back in a decade or so ago, was at one who did a regular program on there. She has come out with a piece. I think this is on Middle East Eye, in fact.
The whole world has to isolate this rogue, apartheid, genocidal, maniac, serial killing, pathologically lying state. Isolate it. Shame anyone who goes there. Academics, celebrities, politicians, and they've been exposed for what they are. And Zionism's on its last leg. It only exists by the weight of its propaganda, and that propaganda's collapsed entirely. The world sees Israel for what it is, and it can't last for long in its current state. You cannot expect change in a society this far gone. It is full-throated fascist, and that's why they act the way they do, with full, total impunity, because they have no humanity left. This is a society so far gone with protection of a military empire, with hatred in their hearts. And we're seeing essentially the Fourth Reich today marching forward, and there's no allied forces coming to save us. The Israeli Knesset just passed a law allowing the execution of Palestinian prisoners, but not Israelis. This is the true face of apartheid Israel. But this is nothing new. I saw this firsthand when I was in Israel back in 2016. Full-throated fascism.
You can't deal with these people. There's no need to try. There's no need to talk to them.
There's only one way. Like, I would carpet bomb them.
You would carpet bomb them?
It's the only way you could deal with them.
I didn't realize this. I didn't realize how viscerally, grotesquely genocidal Israelis were. How openly fascist they would be to anyone.
Jews shouldn't marry Arabs.
Shouldn't marry Arabs. Yeah. Why do you feel strongly about that?
Because Jews is a special nation that God gave it to the Jews. We don't want the Arabs to be here.
They knew that they were on camera. That's what's so alarming to me, too. I wasn't trying to hide. I wasn't doing gotcha journalism. I was going up with a camera and saying, generally, what do you think about the situation?
I think
Israelis have to take over, and they have to kick them away.
I was so horrified and alarmed at the genocidal rhetoric that was being espoused. Every single person, for every generation, every walk of life, they wanted ethnic cleansing. They said we should nuke them. One little girl laughing, we should kill all Arabs. Kill all Arabs.
We need to kill the Arabs.
It shows you the impunity back then, the arrogance to just assume this is what you guys think too, right? You're an American. You agree with me. You guys have been doing the same thing. This is who we are. We're proud racists. We're proudly fascist. I felt like I was walking into Berlin in 1932. I really felt absolutely disgusted. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, just walking a couple steps and as white as I am, are you Arab? Are you Arab? And I'm like, what? I'm an American. Oh, good. We can talk about Arabs then. We can talk about how much we hate Palestinians. I saw the writing on the wall back then. I saw that there's no hope from within Israeli society. I went to rallies where they were calling to kick all the refugees out. You know, these were things that we're told Israel's a safe haven for Holocaust survivors, for genocide survivors. Well, why are all the African refugees put out in the middle of the Negev desert into a concentration camp? Why don't they want any African refugees there? They tokenize Ethiopian refugees, but then they make them take Depo-Provera birth control because they don't want them to reproduce. This is the nature of Israeli society. It's an ethno-state. And it's built on supremacy and hate, because that's what Zionism is.
How many civilians have been killed in Gaza, from what you know?
Who gives a shit?
Okay, but don't you feel like, for example, children?
Children grow up to be Arabs.
You have to continue to expel. You have to continue to kill to keep that artificial majority in place.
If you gave me a button to just erase Gaza, every single living being in Gaza would no longer be living tomorrow. I would press it in a second. I would press it right now. Give me that button and press it right now.
There you go.
And I think most Israelis would.
So that's Abby Martin. And the point of this is, Martin, to look at the reality on the ground, is that for decades, Israeli children have been growing up to think, number one, that they're better, that they're somehow blessed by God. And, of course, the number two of that is that the Arabs, they are Untermensch.
Well, that's right. And maybe somebody should speak to our mainstream politicians here in Britain who are very sympathetic, like Keir Starmer, to Israel's right to exist and that they've got a right to defend themselves, including starving children, because it's about self-defense. That's the reality.
What about self-defense of Iran? Because it's interesting this week, there's been a letter, an announcement made by the Iranians, but with the signatures of lots of journalists around the world, including myself. It's called Six Non-Negotiable Terms from International Scholars and Former Officials from 30 Countries to End the U.S. War on Iran amidst Trump's continued threats of war crimes. That what they say is the conscience of humanity resists everything for us, nothing for others. The creed of the predatory empire erected on the corpses of nations. The shameless rapacity and insolence have reached their zenith, and Trump's threats illustrate the depraved spirit of a decaying civilization. We must not be passive witnesses, but active architects of a new world where arrogance crumbles and righteousness prevails. Well, you can see why they're doing this kind of thing, Martin. In a way, what they've got is by threatening to destroy the civilization of Iran, the intellectuals, the people, the thinking people, the literary people in Iran have come together, and they're saying, well, actually, let's articulate this feeling in our country that this is not just about Iran, it's about civilization everywhere, actually.
Well, the quality of the Iranian leadership is very high. I mean, like you know, most controlled hierarchical systems, if you like. There are elections in Iran. Bezeshkian was elected, but they've got other people in charge. And, you know, the Arigachi is his name, the foreign minister. He's got degrees in maths and languages. Mm. He's an expert on the philosopher Immanuel Kant. I mean, and there's Trump, who basically wouldn't get many O-levels.
So it's almost like this is the idea is this is the triumph of stupidity over intelligence.
Well, I mean, it is, and it isn't.
Or brute force over intelligence.
Yes. Brute force and ignorance.
From the perspective of global justice, the terms for ending this war are absolute and non-negotiable, they say. I say. Number one, guarantees against repetition and a binding international commitment ensuring no future aggression. Any issues with that, Martin? The immediate dismantling of all U.S. military installations in the region. Has the Americans got any real reason to be in the Gulf, in the Middle East at all?
Have they got any reason to be anywhere other than America?
Number three, formal admission of aggression, international condemnation of the aggressors, and full reparations for life and property.
Yes, but of course they have agreed in the ceasefire negotiation that they'll get that money by getting tolls in the Gulf, in the Strait. So there's obviously some flexibility on that, because the chance of getting any money out of them, even if you kick them out of the Middle East, is pretty small.
An immediate end to war on all regional fronts, where they're clearly talking about places like Lebanon as well there.
Well, yes. I mean, if we're going to have a ceasefire negotiation, it's got to be about everything, hasn't it?
And they say a new legal regime for the Straits of Hormuz, recognising Iran's sovereignty.
Yep. We can see why they're going to go for that.
And finally, the prosecution and extradition of operatives in anti-Iranian media who have incited the bloodshed. So they're doing it actually very, very much what happened at Nuremberg to... I think it was in its Stryker and Rosenberg, the two editors of these particularly racist Nazi newspapers were executed.
Yes, and I think I'll just put this forward, that this is somewhat tongue-in-cheek. They know they're not going to get this, but this is exactly what happened at Nuremberg, and the answer is why isn't it going to happen here? Whether they're going to get it or not is another question.
Well, there's a whole list of journalists who've signed this, and I imagine more may be signing it. Richard Falk from the United States, Dennis Halliday from Ireland, Norman Finkelstein, Abby Schleim, Hans von Sponeck. We can go on and on. Chris Williamson is there. The point is, I've signed it too, and what I like to see is... The Iranians have actually taken this initiative to reach out around the world and saying, if you agree that a threat to destroy Iran's civilization is a threat to the whole world, please sign. And I did. What do you think? Is it?
Well, I think what's amazing about the Iranians is because they're a sophisticated place. Educated people in Iran all speak English, as they do everywhere in the world, and in Russia, of course. Most Westerners don't speak Persian and have no intention of learning it. So in actual fact, they've got a much better understanding of how we tick than we've got about how they tick. Because, of course, in the US, there's this like, they're just these crazy religious extremists. Yes, you see Hegseth going on. They've wanted to destroy the world for 47 years, and that's the only image they've got of them. Whereas, in actual fact, of all the Middle Eastern states, Iran is the most sophisticated. It's Shia rather than Sunni, which tends to make... There is a difference. You know, Sunni extremists are the ones behind ISIS and Al-Qaeda, even though they were put together by Western intelligence services. But they are, you know, the Iranian take on all of these things is much more sophisticated. And, of course, they're very good. They've shown that they're very good at trying to get narrative... their narrative going, and of course these Lego videos that they've been putting out have been going around the world. So they've got these kind of letters that you've signed, which is very much for the intellectuals, and for the teenagers, they've got the Lego videos.
Well, back in 2004, a book was published by InterVarsity Press called Christian Zionism, A Roadmap to Armageddon by Stephen Sizer. The term Zionism was first coined in the late 19th century and referred to the movement, the return of the Jewish people to an assured and secure homeland. Ironically, this vision has been largely nurtured and shaped by Christians long before it received widespread Jewish support. And he goes into the history of it. But then he also talks about these various, this is Stephen Sizer, the former reverend from Virginia Water, he was a parish priest there. I think, Martin, the first time he came on our radar, on this programme, was around about 2014 or so, 2013 maybe, when he was told, he was instructed by the Archbishop of Canterbury, you're not allowed to mention the Holy Land in any of your sermons, because he'd shared online a Wikispooks article saying 9/11 Israel did it, all the proof in the world. So he's quite an interesting little parish priest, isn't he?
Well, he is, but of course, as you know, he's been silenced by the hierarchy for the reasons that you've said.
Yeah, he's been slowly elbowed out. But anyway, this is actually, the book is, I mean, it's amazing really to think it was published way back in 2004. And what he's done is by, he's actually spelled out this roadmap to Armageddon. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Stephen Sizer in a talk he gave probably 10 years or so ago. Six steps to Armageddon, he says.
Critical to the Zionist reading of prophecy, many Christian Zionists believe the Jewish temple must be rebuilt on the Haram al-Sharif in place of the Dome of the Rock. And you will find many Christian Zionists supporting and facilitating this to take place. And their hero within the Jewish community is a guy called Gershon Salomon. He's the founder of the Temple Mount Faithful. You might like to get onto his email list and find out what they're up to. The Temple Mount Faithful is committed to destroying the Dome of the Rock and rebuilding the Jewish temple, and the Israeli High Court has given them permission to lay the foundation stones. Twice a year they try and take an articulated lorry through the Dung Gate into the plaza below the Temple Mount area to lay the cornerstones. This is what he said at the International Christian Embassy gathering recently. The mission of the present generation is to liberate the Temple Mount and remove, I repeat, to remove the defiling abomination there. The Jewish people will not be stopped at the gates leading to the Temple Mount. We will fly our Israeli flag over the Temple Mount, which will be minus its Dome of the Rock. It will only have our Israeli flag and our temple. This is what our generation must accomplish. And in the Times newspaper, he was interviewed. And he insisted the Islamic shrine would be destroyed. He said this, quote, in the Times newspaper, hardly a left-wing radical newspaper, the Israeli government must do it. We must have a war. There will be many nations against it, but God will be our general. I am sure this is a test. God is expecting us to move the dome with no fear of other nations. The Messiah will not come by himself. We should bring him by fighting. Now, that sounds remarkably like the zealots of the first century. Gershon Salomon is a regular speaker at Christian conferences and churches, especially in the States. And since 1967, there have been over 100 armed attempts to destroy the Dome of the Rock. And not on a single occasion has a Israeli prime minister or chief rabbi condemned or criticized any of those assaults.
So that's the Reverend Stephen Sizer speaking several years ago. In fact, before this guy Salomon has died. But this the Third Temple Faithful, Martin, they were founded in 1967, funnily enough, because the Six-Day War brought around quite a lot of changes in Jerusalem itself, didn't it?
Well, Jerusalem was never part of the State of Israel as originally envisaged by UN resolutions in 1948, and of course when they seized all this land in 1967, the whole thing was that everybody realised that if we can't let the Israeli Zionists have Jerusalem. They were a tiny minority. There was a Jewish minority in Jerusalem that had lived there for hundreds of years, and they were no problem whatsoever to the locals, and everybody got on fine. But if we give the Israeli, you see, these what they were saying in 1948 is we just need somewhere, anywhere, where we can be safe from horrible Nazis who might kill us. Yeah, and there was even talk that it might be somewhere in Madagascar or Patagonia or just somewhere where we can go. But of course, once you've got them into what used to be, or is still called, the Holy Land, then that brings in all of this, you know, Bronze Age theology that everybody's prepared to kill for. And of course, that's exactly where we've ended up. But they're not supposed to be in Jerusalem at all. Just as we went to war with Serbia to stop them controlling Kosovo, which is in actual fact the heartland of the Serbian, Serbian national, consciousness. Is these days it's now got an Albanian majority, but back in those days it didn't. So we went to war to stop them having it because they can't have it.
The Temple Mount faithful are getting very confident. They're getting very pleased. For example, over Easter, over the last few weeks, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem has been closed by the Israelis. It's now reopened. But this really rather makes them rub their hands. The Temple Mount faithful are still going strong. And they're waiting for the day when the Dome of the Rock, the Muslim mosque that they say is on the same site as the Jewish temple used to be in Jerusalem gets bulldozed.
Well, I mean, that's obviously their goal, just as Modi's BJP destroyed the mosque at Ayodhya, which was a later mosque. This is one of the early, it isn't a mosque actually. The Dome of the Rock is a mausoleum or something like that. There is also a mosque up there. But in any case, that's much older than the mosque that was destroyed at Ayodhya. And of course, incidentally, what the archaeologists believe is that, you know, the Wailing Wall that they all pray against, they're not supposed to be there at all. Let's put it this way. They're not supposed to be there at all. Jerusalem was supposed to be part of Palestine. Yeah, or potentially a city like the Vatican, where everybody could go and nobody would control it. But the actual Wailing Wall, the proper archaeologists think that is the remains of Hadrian's temple to himself, and so that's what it is. It's not the temple that they think it is.
A pagan temple.
A pagan temple to Hadrian. Yeah.
Okay, maybe. But anyway, even the original Jerusalem temple was built by Hiram of Tyre, who was a pagan. They were Canaanites, basically, from people from Tyre.
Well, I mean, it's like saying we've got...
So Solomon was an interesting figure who had this temple built, because he started off a great guy. Apparently he was brilliant. He was writing loads of wonderful stuff. But then he had loads of very, very, very attractive lady dancers manage to make their way into his... and he fell for them. And he is one of those kings you can read about in the Old Testament. He falls from grace. All the prophets then start saying, oh no, things are going to go wrong because the king's going all wrong. He builds this wonderful temple. And that, in a way, the temple that's now, this group, the Temple Mount Faithful, want to build is symbolic of the fall, in fact, of the Judaism of the days of Solomon. So it's very bizarre. And also, it's interesting, you know, you're talking about the Wailing Wall being of Hadrian's temple. So there's all sorts of disputes. None of this is really getting discussed. But I can tell you, there are many Jews that do think about this a lot. And there are, I think these are in the UK, I'm not quite sure, but anyway, a guy called Rabbi Ethanan Beck has been talking all about it. He says, I'm unapologetic, Netanyahu is Amalek. In other words, he's anti-Jewish.
According to the Torah, the state of Israel have no right to exist. But they come so nicely, they arrest you, blah, 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 blah. That's all. No, they're coming and they beat people. On the head, everywhere. You can see that only in the social media, because the mainstream media don't show that.
So you're saying Netanyahu is Amalek?
Netanyahu, I didn't have to say it. This is a fact. Amalek means people who uproot people from God, especially the Jewish people uproot from God. This is the job of Netanyahu, though. And exactly, he is the Amalek. No difference what the price of that is. If the price of that is killing 100 million people, they will do that.
100 million people?
Everything what the price is to wipe up Jordan, Syria, Egypt, Lebanon, wipe them completely up.
They could drop a nuclear bomb on Iran if they wanted to. Do you think if it comes to that, they would?
I think yes, 100%. There's a Jewish hospital in Iran funded completely by the government. Why you don't see that in the news? They just say the Iranian anti-Semites, the Nazis.
Firstly, we have to understand that according to the Torah, the state of Israel have no right to exist. Not only they have no right to go to wage wars on other countries like Gaza, Iran, and Lebanon, and so on. So as you can understand, in today's day, Jewish people have no right to rule the land, even not one inch of any land. And, of course, even not in the Holy Land. The Holy Land, in today's day, according to the Torah, is belongs to the Palestinian in full. Not a two-state, and not all of this. From the river to the sea should go back to the Palestinians in full. Could be the Jewish people can live there. Under a Palestinian government, like Jewish people living today in Iran. Even under the war, they have no problem with Jews. They have a problem with occupiers. They have a problem with the genocide. They have no problem with Jews. The same thing we can live as peaceful citizens, even in Palestine. But the whole land, the government, should go back to the Palestinians in full, and all the Palestinian refugees should come back, and they should get back their homes in the villages like it was before. This is according to the Torah. And this is even the Zionists took the land freely, without any wars, with a free land. Especially when they're doing that on the head of Palestinian people by killing them and exiling them from the land. And this doubles and triples the crimes much, much more. In the Torah it's written in the Ten Commandments, don't kill. Don't steal. This is exactly what the Zion is doing.
So that's the Rabbi Ethanan, Ethanan Beck, B-E-C-K. I'll put a full version of him, unapologetic, up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Martin, how come we're not hearing that Jews are actually welcome in Iran and are at places actually paid for by the government that it actually provides? The idea is that we're being told that this is an Islamic versus Jewish, but actually it's Zionist versus everyone else, surely.
Yeah, did you see that there's actually a synagogue in Iran which has been bombed by the Israelis? It's used by the locals, and it was, you know, they've got permission to have it. It's built in the 1990s. And they've deliberately gone and bombed it.
You say deliberately?
Yes, it's a deliberately targeted.
Why is that significant?
Because they did this in Iraq in the 1950s. They bombed synagogues in Iraq because the Jewish community had been in the Middle East for hundreds of years, thousands of years. They were scattered all over the place, just as they were scattered all over Europe. But most Jews lived outside what is now Israel for thousands of years. Yeah, there was a Jewish community in what is now Israel, but it was quite small, and most of those who identified as Jews lived somewhere else. So they lived in Iraq and they lived in Iran, and there's a Jewish community in Iran, and in fact they've got two seats in the Majlis, which is the Iranian parliament, are reserved for Jews. Yeah. So the Israelis don't like this at all. So the Jews that live in Iran, who are obviously
the wrong sort of Jews,
so they've bombed their synagogue.
And maybe this is just a mistake.
I don't think it is. I think it's quite deliberate.
United States Israeli strikes have completely destroyed a synagogue in Tehran. The attacks across Iran killed more than a dozen people overnight. This is this week. According to preliminary information, the Rafi Nir synagogue was completely destroyed in this morning's attacks. That was reported on Tuesday, so that would have been Monday evening. According to Iran's Mehr news agency, the synagogue was destroyed when an adjacent residential building was also attacked. Footage showed civil defense workers amid the rubble with Hebrew language books scattered on the ground.
I think that the Zionist extremists in Israel have got a motive and means to destroy a synagogue in Tehran. And that's the sort of thing they might do. In Iraq in the 1950s, they bombed synagogues, and then the Zionist agents said to people, you're being attacked by the locals, you're being attacked by the locals, you need to come to live in Israel. So that they were doing that in order to freak people out so that they would go and live in Israel. But the bombings were carried out by Zionists, not by anybody else, because that is their mentality. They've always had what is frankly a fascistic mentality, even towards other Jewish people who don't agree with them.
Well, look, back to Bilderberg for a minute, just as a perspective on this war, because the allegation is that, you know, it's interesting chatting to Dan Dix, it's a conundrum, because the Bilderbergers seem to be the sensible guys. Trump and his camp seem to be the crazy guys. But there is some text which I pulled out of a book. It's called Grand Orient Freemasonry Unmasked by George F. Dillon, who was in the Catholic Church. When the book was published in 1950, chapter 16, The Intellectual and the War Parties in Masonry. What he says in the quote is, he says that at present, all secret societies are divided into two parties, the party of direction and the party of action, or war party. The duty of the intellectual party, now this is, I'm speculating here, the Bilderberg types, is to plot and to contrive. That of the party of action is to combine, recruit, excite, to insurrection and fight. The members of the war party are always members of the intellectual party, but not vice versa. The war party thus know what's being planned, but the other party, concealed as common Freemasons amongst the simpletons of the lodges, cover both sections from danger. So I don't know, I mean, I'm not saying that everyone that goes to a Bilderberg meeting is a Freemason, but certainly it may well be that they are directing at the steering committee level. So anyway, if the war party succeed, the peace party or the intellectual party go forward and seize upon the offices of state and the reins of power. Their men go to the hustings, make speeches, that suit, are written up in the press, which is the world over. Under the Masonic influence, they are cried up by the adroit managers of mobs. They become the deputies, the ministers, the Talleyrands, the Fouchés, the Gambettas, the Ferries, and of course they make the war party generals, admirals and officers of the new army, navy and police. So if the war party fails, the intellectual party, who close their lodges during the combat, appear afterwards as partisans, if possible, of the conquering party, or if they cannot do that, then they silently conspire. They manage to get some friends into power and they agitate. They, in either case, come to the assistance of the defeated war party. They extenuate the faults whilst condemning the heedless rashness of ill-advised good-natured through the too ardent young men. They cry for mercy. They move the popular compassion in time. They free the culprits and they prepare for new commotions. Anyway, that's, I thought, quite an interesting quote from George F. Dillon's book, Grand Orient Freemasonry Unmasked, and does kind of explain, in a way, when I was reading that originally, Martin, I thought about the United Nations, because in a way, the war party at the UN is the Security Council. These are the very, very, the powerful nations have the whip hand here, and the vetoes. Whereas actually it should be the other way around. Surely the General Assembly should have the powers at the UN over the war party or the Security Council. That the whole world should be involved in these decisions, not just the superpowers.
Well, I agree with that, but I think that's a kind of these kind of explanations that say this has always been going. This, what we're looking at here, is good cop, bad cop. Yeah. So the bad cop, like Trump, says, I'm going to destroy you all. And then Carney comes and says, calm down. We're going to do it like this. So that's just basic stuff.
But what they're saying in that quote
more complex
is
theory
that the bad cop faction are also in the good cop faction.
Well, because they're all cops.
But not vice versa.
They're all cops.
So you don't get good cops in the bad cop faction, but you do get... Anyway, so I think it's an interesting way to look at
it. This is the way they do it, isn't it? They try, as you were saying earlier, they try and control everything. So they control... They set things off... They create chaos and then they come along and provide the solution. No, we need you. No, this would listen to me. And of course, it's all about getting what you want and pushing for what you're trying to get. And it's universal, and it's been universal for many years.
Well, one person who's seen how it all operates inside the Foreign Office is Craig Murray, and he was asked to speak at this conference I mentioned at the beginning of the programme. It's called World War III? The Devil in Contemporary History, Comparative Diabology, the Dajjal, the Antichrist, Eschatology, and the Epstein Files, and the War on Iran. So, joint conference on Sunday, April the 5th, 2026. I was there, Craig was there, various people were there, and it was convened by Thomas Daffern, but mainly really by Moeen Yassin, who gave an independent Islamic overview of the current global what he calls polycrisis. But there were, I'm going to hear from a couple of the speakers now. Firstly, though, from Craig Murray, who we know. Well, do you want to introduce Craig? Because we know him quite well. He's been a very, very good commentator over the years.
Well, he used to be British ambassador in Uzbekistan, and he basically denounced the regime, British policy in Uzbekistan was to support the regime, even though it was torturing people. So he spoke out about that, and eventually was pushed out of the Foreign Office. And since then, he's become, a respected campaigner against war. And obviously, being an insider, he's got inside knowledge.
Yeah, it's a very broad spectrum of people at this conference, which lasted most of Easter Sunday. So let's have a listen now to what Craig has to say about what effectively he's explaining here, how it works at the Foreign Office. It's almost like, well, the ambassador, when something evil is going on, whether it's rendition or something like this, the ambassador's not to be found and he's looking the other way.
The ease with which people can become co-opted to evil, because I think they were co-opted to evil. I more clearly see that now. The ease to which people are co-opted, with which people are co-opted to evil, is a very, very difficult question. And now, of course, what we're seeing is the atmosphere of diplomatic nicety and of pretense which surrounded international relations back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, even when millions of people were being killed in a desire to grab Iraq's oil. Now there's not felt to be a need to make that pretense anymore. You know, the current attack on Iran, there's very little pretense at all that it's motivated by anything other than an attempt to manipulate the world's oil markets, to grab Iran's oil if possible. And if that's not possible, to engineer a situation in which fortunes can be made on the oil market. And that this comes immediately after the genocide in Gaza, which nobody in power had any interest in stopping. And one thing that's very, very plain to me is that it illustrates that Western democracy is an utter sham, because I never thought, for example, I never ever thought we would see a situation where a majority of people in the United States actually tend more to support the Palestinians than support the Israelis. In opinion polls, ask that question in various formats. But we are in that situation. And we're in a situation where the majority of people in almost every Western country, except for Germany, why Germany is so utterly weird is an interesting question. It's something much deeper than Holocaust guilt. It's a tendency to genocide. Why, other than Germany, in every other Western country, people were horrified by what was happening in Gaza and horrified by what their own governments were doing. But nobody had any ability to prevent it. There are no levers of power which the population, even when the population is pretty well united in detesting something, the population cannot stop it. We now have a situation where in almost every Western government you can name, in France, in Germany, in the United Kingdom, in Sweden, and in the United States, the government in power has historically low approval levels. In all of those countries at the moment, if you ask them how many people approve of their government, you'll get 15% within 2 or 3% in all those countries will say they approve of their government. And that's not a net figure. That's the number who approve. The number who disapprove is something like 60. The net figure is something like minus 45. And those are absolute record figures. The utter discontent and disconnection of people from what their governments are doing is extreme. And there's a great understanding that the people in power, the so-called elites, don't represent us. The Epstein files I know you've been discussing, and they open up questions which I've often asked. I'd noticed, because, you know, I used to be an ambassador. I spent a lot of time in various ways dealing with extremely powerful people. That extremely powerful people are much more likely than other people to enjoy the act of humiliating and degrading other people, even in everyday work situations, you know, to be just really nasty and unpleasant. And so one question I've always wondered is, why is it, for example, that there seems this very plain extra prevalence of paedophilia among the very powerful than among the general population? These are extraordinary things, and these are signs. I think that we have a society in which a devotion to evil, in which a psychopathic attitude is what gets you power. And perhaps that's a problem with the notion of power. Perhaps power itself is evil. Anyway, I think those are the reflections I'd like to give to you. I'm not quite sure if that's how you expected me to talk. And these are deeply personal things that I grapple with and fail to understand. I don't actually think there is a simple mechanistic explanation that revolves around secret committees and things. I don't deny the existence of organized groups and committees, some of which are secret, but I don't think that there is a mechanistic explanation for the workings of human evil. I don't think that you can find an institutional explanation for why it is that the leaders of states, not just the leaders as a person, but the leadership cadres of powerful states were happy to see Palestinian children massacred, killed, die the most horrible deaths of maiming and pain and extreme agony, see that happen to children and not feel there was any interest in intervening. I don't think there can be an institutional explanation to any of that. I think it comes to something deep-rooted in the human psyche, which is going to out whatever the institutions of power. The only question is what we can do to regulate our societies better to prevent it.
So that's the former ambassador, Craig Murray. I struggled with the editing. I was going to edit the end of that out, but I thought, no, it's only fair to let him have his say. He's saying that he doesn't think that there are mechanisms, you know, secret groups that organise this. Now, I mean, obviously, to say it's Bilderberg, but then again, maybe the Bilderberg is there as an organisation to try and counter the mania, or to control the countering of the mania. But anyway, what do you think about his general sentiment there, Martin, about evil generally?
Well, I think he's trying to make it as general as possible, because evil isn't just to do with individual people or individual structures. It's a part of human nature which we're still grappling with. I'm just reading today, for example, that they've discovered a chimp tribe in, I think it's in Tanzania, and we all know that chimps fight each other. We didn't used to realise that. We thought they were vegetarians, but in actual fact, chimp troops are pretty hostile to each other, and they will fight and kill each other. But what was interesting about this troop was that they had, in fact, been one group all working together, and then they fell out and they had a civil war. Yeah, so chimps that knew each other and were part of the same troop ended up on two different sides, and loads of people. And I think that is, that sort of thing is actually probably hardwired into our biology. In one way, we're more aggressive than chimps because, you know, we're actually, there's a lot of evidence for human violence going back to the Stone Age. But in another way, we're actually less aggressive than chimps because chimps can't tolerate chimps from another group at all. Whereas human beings can, in fact, get on. We're able to communicate. And it's possible to travel around the world without being attacked.
Humans at least have got the potential to rise above this sort of silliness. Anyway, look, another, just as a contrast to I'll put the full half hour of Craig's presentation up on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk, as I will with Matthew Errett. So it's the second time we've had Matt on the show tonight, but here he is actually at that Diabology, the World War III Eschatology conference organised on Easter Sunday, talking about Aleister Crowley, the 666, the famous Satanist.
In 1897, so this got him into Cambridge. In 1897, he was initiated into the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn's Isis Urania Temple in London. The Golden Dawn itself were founded in 1887. All of its leading members were also members of Madame Blavatsky's esoteric section of Theosophy. Blavatsky had herself created Theosophy in order to unveil something called the Age of Isis in her Isis Unveiled. This is, again, highly influential. It popularized such things as the swastika and other things in our current era. I would say both left and right wing strains of fascism have been heavily influenced by Blavatsky's Theosophical doctrines and those spin-off groups, including the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn that came after it. Now, zeroing back into Thelema and Crowley's motives, I think this little excerpt from his confessions that he wrote later on in life is very indicative of what was going on in his mind, where he says, "I accepted the theology of the Plymouth Brethren. In fact, I could hardly conceive of the existence of people who might doubt it. I just simply went over to Satan's side." So here he is talking about this strict, exclusive Plymouth Brethren sect that he was born into, created by John Nelson Darby, the founder of premillennial dispensationalism and rapture theology that so shaped the Christian evangelical mindset, especially in America. Now, Crowley is saying he never actually disagreed. He always maintained the belief that Darby was correct, but he just simply saw the other side. So quickly, to understand the devil, I think it's going to be important just to simply look at what was Darby actually saying. What did he believe? Well, he basically, in short, there's much more to it, asserted that God has a changing relationship to humankind, defined by millennialist thousand-year dispensations, of which there would be seven in total before the full end of the universe. And this is actually something that he took from a Jesuit scholar named Francesco Rivera and another earlier Christian eschatologist named Joaquino Fiore, and some earlier Sibylline traditions that had existed even back in the Roman Empire times. Darby's seven ages were effectively, number one, the age of innocence, the age of conscience, the age of government, the age of patriarchy, which went on from Abraham to Moses, the age of Mosaic law from Moses to Jesus, and then the age of grace, which was apparently Jesus to the present. And the age of seven was up for dispute. Now, Darby's thousand-year reign of the Antichrist, the thousand-year reign of Christ would be preceded by a seven-year period in Darby's view of tribulation, where the Antichrist would rain hell and havoc and murder on the world. Crowley basically said, yeah, that's true, except I'm the guy to do it. I'm the guy to usher in that what he called the Age of Horus. Now, Darby had commissioned one of his top leading Plymouth Brethren scholars by the name of George Pember to write a book called The Antichrist, Babylon, and the Coming of the Kingdom, where Pember had configured an argument for Babylon and the need to recreate Babylon out of within the Holy Land somewhere. And he says, the wonder is that the restoration of Babylon has never yet been attempted. As soon, however, as Christendom is united in the form of the 10 Confederate Kingdoms, all jealousy will be at an end, and the great prize may then be seized for the common good. No doubt commerce will be the exciting motive. The civilized world will perhaps combine to build a great central emporium, which by their united exertions will quickly surpass all other cities and finally become the capital of the Antichrist. Sounded pretty good up until that very last sentence. You're like, oh, the reason why you want to build this great common, this great emporium of progress for the common good is to be usher in the Antichrist at the end of the day. So what the hell is that? All right. Some of the big followers of Darby from the Plymouth Brethren, exclusive Brethren sect that had an inner teaching for the exclusive initiated and an outer teaching for the uninitiated, included this figure, Ord Wingate, who was a co-founder of the Haganah, a leading figure with Jabotinsky, and who worked closely as well with Michael Sykes of Sykes Pico fame, who was the official biographer of Wingate, actually. His cousins included T.E. Lawrence and E.G. Brown, Brown being a patron and sponsor of Jamal al-Din al-Afghani of Salafist fame, and T.E. Lawrence, a handler of the a Hashemite whisperer. So, Thelema is what? As I said, it was channeled through a ritual in 1904. Now, the idea was to replace all religions and unify new synthetic religions, including modified Abrahamic-rooted faiths in the New Age, which will dominate the Aeon of Horus. IOS was known as an emissary of Horus, as I mentioned already, and it involved a trinity of deities called Nuit, Hadit, and Ra Hurquit. That is, those were other names given for Isis, Osiris, and Horus. And Horus was known as the age of the crowned and conquering child, was his idea of Horus. Crowley says that this Aeon of Horus will be a time of unconstrained personal freedom in which a handful of supermen, led by Crowley, sort of the Nietzschean Übermenschen, would perfect their wills and become gods. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law for the supermen. They will delight in wines and strange drugs, which shall not harm ye at all, as well as every kind of sexual excess. Meanwhile, the rest of humanity, the slaves, shall be made to serve the supermen. Compassion is the vice of kings, IOS told Crowley. Unlike the age of Aquarius, which was presumed to be a harmonious and smooth transition to the new age, his age of Horus must be inaugurated by total war of destruction and death. Crowley also said, there is a magical operation of maximum importance, the initiation of a new aeon. When it becomes necessary to utter a word, the whole planet must be bathed in blood. Before man is ready to accept the law of Thelema, the great war must be fought. This bloody sacrifice is the critical point of the world ceremony of the proclamation of Horus, the crowned and conquering child, as the lord of the aeon. A few other points here just to point out. So, got a very clear idea of what he wants this new aeon to be, which will involve Thelema as the new religion of for the godmen to lord over their slaves. It's a master-slave religion. He involves several new rituals that he innovates, including the rites of Eleusis, the world's first drug rave, where peyote and other psychedelics were infused into essentially music that he wrote under a revival of the ancient Eleusinian mysteries. The Gnostic Mass, he also modified and essentially created the Gnostic Mass, which is still popular amongst Gnostic circles today. He developed various sex magic rites and a Babylon working ritual using scarlet women, with the idea that if you do things with the right incantations and rituals, a lot of this followed some John Dee work as well that he had been working on, then you could have a demon literally take over your body while you're procreating with a scarlet woman, basically a throwaway woman who would then be impregnated to be the seed and host of the Antichrist.
So that's just an extract, but really is going into Crowley, Martin. And I mean, this guy clearly was trying. I mean, what do you make of Aleister Crowley? I mean, he's a self-confessed Satanist. So that's, called himself the 666. And he's also saying, well, rather than have some sort of smooth transition, I think it'll work a lot better if we have a massive war.
Well, this era that we're talking about, which is about just over 100 years ago.
Between the First and Second World Wars, yeah.
I mean, the Plymouth Brethren are obviously older than that. But, I mean, this is the idea of esoteric powers that people can develop has obviously been very influential. You know, I mean, Crowley was still being quoted in the 1960s as a kind of, a precursor of people like Timothy Leary and so on. I'd say that all of these things, I would say, from my point of view, is it's a bit different if you lived in rural China, because nobody believed any of these things. They had a completely different
The way it works, it seems to me, is you've got these theoreticians and what you might call mystics out there, like Crowley. But then you've also got people quietly behind the scenes pushing for this and that to happen.
Well, I think what you've got is you've got material interests, which are obviously at work in what's going on in the world now and previously. And you've got all these people who've got all these esoteric ideas, which they basically raided the historical record. And, you know, they think that they know about Egyptian religion, which, of course, we know a bit about it, but you know how Hitler happened
exactly like this. The whole sort of Nazi Party mythos that was created in the 1920s and the 1930s was manufactured in a similar sort of way. So the idea you're twisting history for your own end. So people are just learning this stuff, they believe it, they're getting excited by it, but actually they've no idea how it's been weaponized.
Well, I know, but it's been weaponized, and it's obviously the very idea of esoteric knowledge is, in a sense, real knowledge, like a physics, is not esoteric.
Well, he's saying
it may be difficult to understand, but it's not esoteric.
He's saying it's all been channeled. Maybe it's just him. You know.
Well, that's right, but I mean, this stuff is incredibly attractive. Just think of all the films that have been made about the supernatural and esoteric.
The Lord of the Rings, all the rest of it. People love this stuff. Well, it's
Does it describe how to make a hypersonic missile? And the answer is no, it doesn't.
If
you want to make a hypersonic missile,
where those hypersonic missiles are used. Yeah, it's not just about arms, it's about hearts and minds, and that's what all this stuff is about. So the Lord of the Rings is nothing really. I mean, it's in a way, it's a book which has been written as a sort of pastiche and a counter to a lot of this stuff. But anyway, look, so I will put up a link to this Easter Sunday conference on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, and I'll make sure that Matt's presentation and Craig's is definitely up. There may be some more too, because I gave one, but that's neither here nor there. But I also spoke to Moeen Yassin, who was the convener of this year's conference based in Istanbul at Global Vision 2000.
Given that we could be heading towards a massive, like, World War III cataclysm, how would you advise that listeners can prepare for that?
can you prepare for that? I'm putting the question to you. It's an inevitability. Well, let me be positive. The current world, I mentioned Adam and Eve. Since then, how many humans have we got? 8 billion? Yeah? Now, you know and I know that the world we're living in, there's no point talking about Judaism, Christianity, or Islam. It's basically a Dajjalic world order, or new world order, you know, in which atheism, secularism, and so on, different variations, is in control. So I would call it a Dajjalic world order in which Ribba, which is totally condemned, runs the whole system, and which is controlled by a few people. So the current system is Dajjalic already. The only thing that's missing about end times is the Dajjal, the actual character, the individual, hasn't appeared. But because a lot of humans, whether they're Muslim, Christian, or Jew, are misled, and they are following the Dajjalic system, there is need for a polite word, cleansing, a washing machine. It's not on. So basically, whether we like it or not, I'm not justifying it. I'm trying to explain it or understand it. If there's a global war, it's going to be a bloodshed, given the weapons we have. I don't just mean nuclear, biological, chemical. Indeed, it's mentioned, you said preparation. According to the Hadith, some Hadith anyway, if you remember the Koi Foundation seminar in London about 10 years ago, even the Ayatollah mentioned 2 out of 3 people will disappear, will end. However, that is not the end of the world. So the thing is, there is going to be a cleansing.
So that's it. Cleansing is what he calls it. Yeah, it could be a bit crazy. But anyway, well done, Moeen, for organising another one of these, particularly at very short notice. The previous one was in December. But when the Anglo-Zionist Empire ups the ante, as it did with this unprovoked war on Iran, so it's a good idea to revisit these things. And he's done a fantastic job at doing that. I think we'll finish with a piece about World War One. Now, there's a couple of Irish authors, Martin. I don't know if you've come across them. Jim McGregor and John O'Dowd have written a whole series of books on the First World War and the Second World War. And so I think maybe this week we will have a little clip of them talking about the First World War, and next week one about the Second World War. But they're basically saying that all these wars were organised via the British royal family.
Well, the British Empire has a lot to answer for in relation to the creation of wars, and the royal family are at the heart of the British Empire. So to that extent, it's not even controversial. Britain has been a major source of violence ever since the Civil War, and then the creation of the big beginning. You know, the first two colonies of Britain were Ireland and Jamaica.
I think their latest book, which has come out last year in April, is called Two World Wars and Hitler. Who was responsible? Anglo-American money, foreign agents, and geopolitics. So we'll have a look at World War II next week, but this week let's have a listen to these two. This is Jim McGregor and John O'Dowd talking about World War One.
One wintry afternoon in February 1891, three men were engaged in London. From that conversation were to flow consequences of the greatest importance to the British Empire and to the world as a whole. For these men were organising a secret society that was for more than 50 years to be one of the most important forces in the formulation and execution of British imperial and foreign policy. And it went on to name some of the men. Cecil Rhodes was one of them. I don't know if you know that name. He was a British man, but a very rich diamond mining magnate and gold in South Africa, and made a fortune. He was the guy, actually, that left his money to set up the Rhodes Scholarships at Oxford University. Quite a few well-known Americans went there as scholars, including Bill Clinton. So this guy's telling us, he names the guys and he tells us that King Edward VII, the monarch at the time, was involved with this society, and their goal was to use the vast fortune Rhodes had made and the money. Nathaniel Rothschild, one of arguably the richest man in the world at the time, he was a member of the secret society. Vast amounts of money. And they were going to use this money initially, in the first instance, to bring America back into the fold with Britain. And together they would form what's now called, and was called at the time, the Special Alliance between Britain and the United States, where they would always be close to each other. They would always fight on the same sides in any wars, always support each other in wars. And so that was this book. And as I say, people. The other thing that this guy was saying was, this author, was that these people were so rich, they controlled politics in Britain. They had all these bribed and paid political puppets, basically, and through that they controlled the politics in Britain. They also controlled the press. They bought up all the major newspapers, and they controlled education, including the writing and the teaching of the history of their own time. So they were able to, through that control, they were able to whitewash, basically, their existence from the historical record. And they controlled this, they controlled education and the teaching of history through the control of Oxford University. It highlights Oxford University continually as the main partners. And let me just, I know people, as I said earlier, people say this guy who wrote this book must be some crazy off-the-wall conspiracy stuff. Secret societies want to make war in Germany, want to control the world with America, Anglo-American global control, a new world order. A lot of the things, incidentally, have come to pass. The guy's name is Carol Quigley. And this guy was a Boston Irish Catholic who attended the Boston High School and Harvard University. He did history. He was top student in his year, every year. Summa cum laude graduate. He taught at history. He taught history at Yale after his graduation, did a PhD and did a master's degree. He's all sorts of postgraduate. This guy was a... And he was headhunted as a fairly young man to be the professor of history at the School of Foreign Services at Georgetown University. Now, this, let me read you some of this guy's credentials. He served on the editorial board of Current History of the Big American Magazine, Big American History Journal. He was a member of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the American Anthropological Society, the American Economic Association, and in addition to his university teachings, quickly lectured at the Armed Forces College, the U.S. Armed Forces College, the Brookings Institution, the U.S. Naval Weapons Laboratory, the Naval College, the Foreign Services Institute of the State Department. He was a consultant to the Smithsonian Institute, and he was on the Congressional Select Committee, which set up NASA. In short, this guy, Quigley, who wrote this book, was at the very pinnacle of his academic career in America. One of the top academic historians in America, in the world, in fact. The other thing, excuse me, I'll just take a quick drink. My throat's getting dry, sorry. So he tells us in his book that he could back up everything he said in it with evidence. And he was assisted, he tells us he was assisted by an academic historian from Oxford University. And his name was Sir Alfred Zimmern. And this guy, like Quigley, was no conspiracy theorist. He was a leading British historian, political scientist, and professor of international relations at Oxford University. He was a member of the British Board of Education and the Political Intelligence Department of the Foreign Office. He was a co-founder of the Royal Institute for International Affairs and drafted the blueprint for the League of Nations. Like Quigley, this guy Zimmern, his good friend Zimmern, was at the very pinnacle of the academic career. How he got this information, how Zimmern got this information and passed to Quigley, was he had been a member of this society. He had been drafted in as a member. It was probably, it started off with maybe 20 or 30 very rich, powerful people. At the time we're now talking about, Quigley lists about 120, a close, tight inner circle, outer circles, and helpers and all the rest of it. Zimmern had been right in at the very heart, the inner circle of the secret society. He knew where all the bodies were buried. So that's two of the world's eminent historians are telling us this. And I had followed all the British historians, and I thought our guys were all heroes, and starting at every war memorial and every village and town in Britain. These men died for freedom and civilization against an evil that was Germany, and they're all heroes to man and now safe in the hands of God. All that stuff. And this, here was me, my mind was getting blown apart with this stuff Quigley was telling us. And I I spent, when I got this book, it took me a while to read because it's packed with information. And I read it, made notes, and as soon as I finished it, I started reading it again, made notes, and then I read it a third time, and I was beginning to get a grasp of it. And I started looking at every single person that Quigley named in this secret society, this very rich and powerful cabal. And I spent years digging into their backgrounds and what they were doing and what they were doing at the time of the First World War. And did they have any influence in the war? And to a man, virtually every single one was deeply involved in a conspiracy to cause a war against Germany. And they wanted to do that because Germany by this time was a burgeoning new young country, industrially, commercially, every way. It was blossoming. They were opening colleges everywhere, teaching all the young people science and what have you. And the British and American elites knew that this was going to be potentially a big hurdle to their control, their global control.
So I'm not sure if that is Jim McGregor or John O'Dowd, all centering really around this book, Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley.
Well, obviously, I haven't read the book. I've read loads of books about the First World War. I'm just reading a book about the Battle of the Marne.
Well, maybe you should.
Well, no, I mean, I'm aware of these conspiracy theories because I've read about them on the internet.
You see that he's not a conspiracy theorist. He's a historian. And the thing is that Tragedy and Hope is an amazing, miraculous, in a way, window into a world which was always supposed to be secret.
Well, I understand what the claims that are being made for this kind of book.
So why do you think the First World War happened then?
I don't know, Tony. It's actually quite complicated. People think that there's an explanation. Maybe there isn't one.
Maybe you should read Tragedy and Hope then.
Well, maybe you should read some of the books I've read.
Okay. I said it first. We're back after Easter. And we'll finish tonight with Patrizia's poem, which is Ode Enemies of God. A prophecy for World Wars III been writ for all to see. A gang of crooks, our world they've hooked to be or not to be. Societies of secrecy, two sides of Freemasonry, divide in two, oh what a coup, both sides a motley crew, direction, action, what of traction, a rag team through and through, brains and hands these tag teams stand, the brains contrive and plot, behind the scenes strategic reams, the hands incite to rot, a state within a state, 'tis true, with asymmetric clues. In days of old, as Pike foretold, each war would lead us to what we see, a catastrophe, by God-haters through and through. So that's Reims is Hebrew, apparently. So anyway, thanks very much for that, Patrizia. And we will have a bit more from those two. I think these Jim McGregor and John O'Dowd, I think one of them's died now, but they have been doing some, I think, amazing work in digging out this whole mystery. I mean, whatever you say about the First World War, there was a book actually called The Cousins War. You've got George V, you've got Kaiser Bill, and Tsar Nicholas, all three of them are cousins. It's just like a family squabble.
Yes, it is. It's a family squabble in Europe because we dominated the rest of the world. But in World War III, the Iranians aren't in Europe, nor are the Chinese, and the Russians are going to the east. So well,
we're talking about, I mean, with Albert Pike particularly, you're talking about how this has led to the creation of the State of Israel, right? So the First World War did. And one of the things that these guys look at is how in 1916 there was basically an armistice, but there were conspiracies behind the scenes to kick off the war again for another 2 years.
But in 1917, there was Wilson actually, who's the president of the US, proposed peace without victory. And then he came into the war on the British side and there was a revolution in Russia. There's a massive massive, as you can imagine, literature about all of this. Everybody likes to think that by reading a book, they've found the answer.
No.
I don't think that's true.
No one thinks that. And you don't, do you? You
no, I don't. I think in actual fact...
Well, you say everybody thinks it, but you don't.
No, I think in actual fact, reality is quite complicated.
I think we have to ask you next week, make sure you've read Tragedy and Hope. Actually, I think it's about something like 800 pages long, so that won't be so easy. Anyway, it's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activists for putting up with me for 3 hours nearly. Martin Summers, also to our guests, Charlie Skelton, to Dan Dix, to Moeen Yassin, and we had another one. I saw Adil Raja, too, and also to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Please download this show as an MP3 from 11 o'clock tonight to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do share interviews and story tips on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group. Also on WhatsApp and my Facebook page, you can download this show and the full-length interviews, subscribe to the free weekly newsletter, donate, or even set up a small monthly sub to Dan as well, of course. Thanks if you already do. That's all at the show page this week, oneword.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. We're streaming live now from Bristol on the Talk Radio stream at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, at holylandradio.com in West Sweden, Wisconsin, 87.7 FM, and also live on the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. You can guarantee we'll have those Bilderberg lists up online later this evening. Have a relaxing, enjoyable weekend. Not quite feeling as warm enough as spring yet, but things are starting to warm up, aren't they? Do join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. Don't just love thy neighbour, love everyone, even the Satanists, and don't let the synagogue of satanic rabbits get you down. Let the ladies drive.
Chapter 2. My child, when you come to serve the Lord, prepare yourself for testing. Set your heart right and be steadfast, and do not be impetuous in time of calamity. Cling to him and do not depart, so that your last days may be prosperous. Accept whatever befalls you, and in times of humiliation, be patient, for gold is tested in the fire, and those found acceptable in the furnace of humiliation. Trust in him, and he will help you. Make your way straight, and hope in him. You who fear the Lord, wait for his mercy. Do not stray, or else you may fall. You who fear the Lord, trust in him, and your reward will not be lost. You who fear the Lord, hope for good things, for lasting joy and mercy. Consider the generations of old and see, has anyone trusted in the Lord and been disappointed? Or has anyone persevered in the fear of the Lord and been forsaken? Or has anyone called upon him and been neglected? For the Lord is compassionate and merciful. He forgives sins and saves in time of distress. Woe to timid hearts and to slack hands, and to the sinner who walks a double path. Woe to the faint-hearted who have no trust, therefore they will have no shelter. Woe to you who have lost your nerve. What will you do when the Lord's reckoning comes? Those who fear the Lord do not disobey his words, and those who love him keep his ways. Those who fear the Lord seek to please him, and those who love him are filled with his law. Those who fear the Lord prepare their hearts and humble themselves before him. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord, but not into the hands of mortals. For equal to his majesty is his mercy, and equal to his name are his works.